But that didn't stop the crowds from turning out at the Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena, California. The crowd was estimated at 800,000, the same as last year. Correspondent Laura Weitz was in the crowd.
The South Bomber flew over earlier to standing cheers. People went wild, but this is now a tradition. It's several years in a row.
A crowd favorite was the Springtime Symphony Float. It had eight waterfalls and giant animated woodpeckers, owls, and other creatures. In keeping with the national terror alert, more than 1,000 federal and local law enforcement officers fanned out among the spectators. British Airways canceled one of its three daily flights from London to Washington, D.C., following security advice from the British government. A Department of Transport spokeswoman said she was unable to comment on matters of security or whether the cancellation was a result of a specific threat. The same flight was isolated yesterday at Dulles Airport. Some passengers were questioned. A small plane crashed into a neighborhood in Dallas today. Two people believed to be on board are presumed dead. Officials say no one on the ground was hurt. The crash set two homes on fire. The plane had just taken off from a nearby airport. An Iranian official estimates the death toll will be enormous, but maybe not as high as some have figured from Friday's earthquake in Bam. Correspondent Ali Akbar Durrani is in Kerman, Iran.
He told me that by this morning, 26,500 bodies have been recovered and buried. He said he expects that the final death toll will exceed 30,000 dead, but he said certainly the death toll will not reach 40,000.
Three survivors have been found in the rubble. Looks like John Edwards' name is not going to appear on the Democratic presidential ballot in Rhode Island. Election officials say he didn't submit enough signatures. The candidate had to submit 1,000 valid signatures from registered voters by December 10th to qualify for the Rhode Island ballot. This is AP Network News. Lawmakers have a lot to do once the second session of the 108th Congress begins. Jerry Bodlander has details.
After passing a huge tax cut bill as well as the Medicare overhaul, the Republican-controlled Congress tries again to approve a comprehensive energy bill, which is one of the president's top domestic priorities. It was stalled last year because of a controversial provision that protected the makers of the gasoline additive MTBE from lawsuits. An effort to limit class action lawsuits is also in limbo, and lawmakers also still have to deal with the threat of sanctions by the European Union. Jerry Bodlander, Washington.
The owners of three big lottery tickets haven't come forward yet. Two tickets were sold for the $221 million Powerball prize. The tickets were sold in Pennsylvania and South Carolina. Meantime, there is still no winner to claim the $162 million Mega Millions jackpot. That ticket was sold in South Euclid, Ohio, outside Cleveland. Lottery offices in all three states are closed today. The search for survivors continues in Baghdad following last night's explosion at a local restaurant. Lourdes Navarro has details.
Rescue workers were looking for survivors overnight in the rubble of Nabil restaurant where a car bomb struck on New Year's Eve. More bodies were found beneath the debris and now the death toll is 8 instead of 5. The U.S. military says the car that exploded was packed with 500 pounds of explosives.
Witnesses report seeing a man running from a vehicle before the explosion. Afghanistan's constitutional convention has been delayed. Opponents of President Hamid Karzai staged a boycott. They don't like Karzai's insistence on a strong presidency. The constitutional convention is an attempt to put a post-Taliban government in place in Afghanistan. The head of auditing firm Grant Thornton's Italian unit has resigned, and his partner has been suspended following their detentions in the growing Parmalat financial fraud scandal. They're suspected of helping to contribute to the company's bankruptcy through false accounting and fraud. Nicole Winfield in Rome reports the scandal is taking on a global scope.
Parmalat is an international company. It has operations in 30 countries, including the United States, where it's the third largest cookie maker. And there are other companies involved. Grant Thornton, an international auditing firm, has a branch here in Italy.
Parmalat's jailed founder has put the size of the hole in its finances at $10 billion. Egypt is sending its top envoy to the West Bank to talk to Yasser Arafat about working out a ceasefire with the Israelis. Arafat has been confined to his headquarters in Ramallah for more than a year by Israeli troops. Eight Israelis and Palestinians are on their way to an expedition to climb an unnamed, unconquered mountain in Antarctica. They vow to cooperate under very difficult and dangerous conditions. The mission of the six men and two women is called Breaking the Ice. The team includes a Palestinian who was jailed for 3 years in Israel for attacking Israeli soldiers. The expedition leader says he hopes the mission can be a good example in the Middle East of how different people can live and cooperate together. Ed Donahue, AP Network News.
I'm Stephanie DeLuca with the KNRC forecast from the Weather Channel. Starting up first day of 2004 with lots of sun, just a few clouds, topping out at 54. Later on tonight, partly cloudy down to 25. And tomorrow, mirror of today, lots of sun, just a few clouds at 54. But for Saturday, the clouds roll in. Chance of snow showers, cooler, high of 25. For the Weather Channel, I'm Stephanie DeLuca on AM 1150 KNRC.
Jim Conder here talking with Bev Rouleau from International Optique. Bev, fashion eyewear the best in the city and now a sale. Bev, what's up with that?
Jim, International Optique is having our annual sale now through January 15th, and it's a blowout.
I know the details. If you purchase prescription frames and lenses at International Optique at Tamarack Square or International Optique at University and Orchard, you receive a 25% discount.
It's a family affair at International Optique. Just bring your family and friends. Everyone receives 25% off their new frame and lenses.
And don't forget to use your Flex dollars while saving money. If you run out of time to use your Flex dollars, come in for a gift certificate to be used later.
Jim, the excitement about International Optique is that we carry frames with a little attitude or a lot of attitude. Either way, let our staff make sure you walk out looking beyond fabulous.
For the best in eyewear in Denver, join International Optique at Tamarack Square or International Optique at University in Orchard now through January 15th for their spectacular 25% off prescription frame and lens sale. It's not what you know, it's who you know, and we know International Optique.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Spreading the holiday spirit and celebrating the opening of its newest store in Southeast Aurora, Lowe's is bringing SpongeBob SquarePants to the Children's Hospital of Denver. Lowe's volunteers are now redesigning and transforming the hospital's child outpatient health clinic into a seaworthy adventure. Upon completion of the project on Tuesday, December 23rd, Lowe's and SpongeBob will celebrate with the children by delivering gifts to them at the Children's Hospital of Denver.
Some people prefer the right wing. Others prefer the left wing. Hear both sides talk on AM 1150 KNRC. Our diverse lineup of talk show hosts features more viewpoints and perspectives than any other Denver talk station. Join Greg Dobbs from 6 to 10 a.m. Bill O'Reilly from 10 till noon. Enid Goldstein from noon to 3. Doug Kellett from 3 to 6. Dominic and Bill from 6 to 9 p.m. Lionel from 9 to midnight, followed by Alan Combs. Get your side, get their side. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Where are the clouds? Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps Terry around, one who can't move. But where are the clouds? Send in the clouds. Just when I...
208, 8 minutes after 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Tuesday edition of Enid Live. And with me live in studio, the singer of that wonderful song, a song that has been much parodied, but is beautiful when you sing it, Judy Collins. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The book, her new book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. You can meet her tonight at Tattered Cover, Cherry Creek, 7:30, but you have to get there by 6:30 because
yeah.
They're expecting quite a crowd, and they're going to be giving out free tickets. Talk to me about the book.
Well,
what prompted you to write the book?
Of course, this is a book that is terribly personal, but the thing about suicide is it affects so many people, and there are so many people who are touched by it in some way in their lives. I had lost my son in 1992 to suicide, and throughout the years, I was writing about the subject, and I was writing meditations and prayers to kind of get through it, and writing a lot about the history and doing a lot of reading and study and trying to figure out why there's such a terrible taboo about the subject. And I decided that I would have to share that with people, and I wanted to write a book just about the subject. And so I've done it, and I'm hoping that there is some healing and that some people would be able to be helped by what I've been through.
How old was your son?
My son was 33.
Did you know, is that your only child? Was that your
yes,
only child?
Yes, he was.
And were you aware that he was, I'm assuming that when you commit suicide, you're very depressed. Were you aware that he was that close?
You know, there are many, many things about suicide that are mysterious. Depression among them. My son was an alcoholic and had a drug and alcohol problem and was using on and off in his early years, right up through the age of 25, and then he got sober. And he had a wonderful 7 years of sobriety and had a wonderful family and had a child who's now 16, actually, my divine granddaughter. And but then he went into relapse. But we know about alcoholism that it is a disease and that relapse is part of the game, part of the risk. And also we know that alcoholics, when they're drinking, have a higher rate of suicide. And for good reason, because when you're drinking, you're really not rational. And other elements like mental illness, like depression, like biochemical imbalance can take a part. So everyone who takes their life has a reason. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it's the condition in which they are that dictates whether they take an action on the suicide or not. But it is a medical condition. It's not a moral issue. And it's not a matter of, it must have been your fault. There are no guilts in suicide.
How did you hear about it? Where were you? Where was he?
He was in Minnesota. I was in New York, planning my trip to see him. And I heard about it from one of my brothers came to my house to tell me.
And,
so I heard about it in person.
And this had to be...
Oh, it was the worst. I mean, you know, you have the grief, you have the shock, you have the sudden loss, you have all the things that you have with all griefs. And in addition to that, with suicide, you get this legacy which has been laid on survivors by the culture, and which is, finally, I'm saying in this book, enough. We have to talk about it. We have to talk about the issues that surround it. And we have to lift that cloud off of the survivors, because the real difficulty in survival comes from thinking that somehow we may have caused it, and we didn't.
So it's a legacy of guilt.
It's a legacy of guilt that's got to be wiped out. You know, people tell me all the time, I meet people who say, oh, there was a suicide in my family, and, you know, my mother's brother killed himself, and we never mentioned his name again. Never. It's like they're disappeared, like some of those South American countries where political enemies are disappeared, or just plain old people. You know, that's why I support Amnesty International, because so many people in the world are harvested in this shameful attempt to kind of get rid of them. Suicides are often gotten rid of psychologically in the same kind of awful way. We never see them. We never think about them. We don't talk about how wonderful they were or how angry we were about the death.
That's another
big part of it.
That's true. And people don't talk about that with death, but there's a lot of anger with death.
A
people that you
anger.
Love the most, it's like, how can you leave me? How
exactly.
could you die? Even if it's an expected, you know, a terminal kind of situation.
And nothing is ever anything but a surprise, because death is always the greatest surprise.
Excuse me. My guest is Judy Collins. Her new book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. Did you have any addiction problems, Judy?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm...
let's hear it. Complain, Judy.
Listen, Enid, I'm a regular girl. I'm a woman of many experiences. And I hardly know how I would have handled life if I hadn't had to deal with addiction. My goodness. I wouldn't have been a true child of the 60s, I guess.
Well, what addiction? List them on multiple pages for us.
Well, let's start with sugar. That was always
a good
one.
Oh, well, how about chocolate?
That's still, of course.
For me, that's my drug of choice.
Still the drug of choice. But I had a real, I drank for 23 years. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, and under all circumstances, happy or sad.
How could you perform?
Well, I didn't drink when I performed. For the most part. And I was very fortunate because I was very well trained. I had such a good training as a professional, even as a child, you know, I have a friend who says that she wasn't raised, she was trained as a child. I was trained as a child with Brico, my teacher.
If anybody hasn't seen the film, it's called what, Antonia?
Antonia, A Portrait of the Woman.
It's a wonderful film, and it's what, now out on
it's
DVD?
It's now on DVD, and of course it's about a real Denver heroine, Dr. Antonia Brico, who was my teacher, but also was the first pioneer woman conductor in the country. And she conducted major symphony orchestras from 1929 right on through, and she had her own orchestra in here in Denver. And so I made a film about her, which was nominated for an Academy Award.
It was
Award.
A wonderful film. And for people who don't know, you're a Denver girl. Your dad was in radio in Denver.
Yeah. And he was a real hero here in this city. People knew Chuck Collins Calling, and he was a star. Everybody on the street would stop him, and people would say, "Oh, you're Chuck's daughter. You know, you must just have such a wonderful life."
Was he around to see your huge success?
Oh yes, he really was. He died in 1968, and by then, it was just, I suppose, that was the following year that I had my, no, probably it was 68. I had it for my first really big hit, and but I had been making records and been a successful performer for many years before that.
Is your Chelsea Morning the reason that Bill Clinton and Hillary named their daughter Chelsea?
Well, I'll tell you two versions of that. They have said that he's always been wonderfully vocal about my music and loving my music. Both the Clintons have, and I just adore them. And Bill said when I first got to know them, they had said, what record would you keep if you had to take just one record out of your collection? This was when he was still governor, and he said, "Oh, that's easy, Colors of the Day." And I was so shocked. He named all the songs, and he actually knew what he was talking about. And so they are fans, and I had been to the White House a lot and gotten to know them very well. But I thought it was very funny that they've always told me that they named Chelsea after my version of Chelsea Morning. But when I saw the first lady on the Joni Mitchell show, she told Joni that she had named Chelsea after Joni's song. I guess
spoken like a true politician.
I guess the favorite singer is who's in the room. It's not fair. They've been wonderful to me, and I'm devoted to them. I wish she would run. I wish she would run.
A lot of people wish she would run.
I wish she would run. I think she is.
But she represents you in New York.
She represents me in New York, and I would not want to lose her as a senator. Because she's really first rate. She's made a fine senatorship out of her election, and I'm sorry to say that if she did run, I would lose a great senator, but gain a great president.
You can meet Judy Collins tonight at Tattered Cover, 7:30, Cherry Creek. Get there at 6:30 if you want tickets. Okay, you were drinking.
What
are the list of addictions? Drinking? Were you doing drugs?
Well,
you're a musician.
I did what was around.
What
know?
Was around?
I was sort of a people pleaser, and I suppose there were times when there were other drugs, but. And, you know, basically I had all the signs of depression. I had a suicide attempt when I was 14.
You attempted
my own. I had lots of years and years of therapy to deal with my panic attacks, with my depressions. Fortunately, even in those early years when I was 25, 26, when I was having tremendous success already, I mean, it was the sort of harbinger of what was to come, which is this wonderful career that I have today, and the singing all over the world, and the making records, and yet there I was. I learned early on that I had to apply the discipline that I knew about music to my physical life. So right away in my early 20s, I started exercising like a fiend, and that probably saved my life, that and the therapy that I had.
Well, here's what's remarkable, because this is radio, people can't see you. You look fabulous.
Thank you.
And it looks like the kind of fabulous that is natural.
Yeah, it is. I'm a no-natural girl. I mean, the only thing I do is drink a little Diet Coke sometimes.
This doesn't look like the stuff that was sculpted. I love these prominent people who spend a fortune to be sculpted by a cosmetic surgeon, and then they do a video how you can look like that if you only eat and exercise a certain way. Anyway, you look fabulous. So these years of drinking... don't show on you at all.
Well, I'm very lucky.
What happened? How did you finally... In other words, take us back for a moment. Here you are. You're beginning to have your success. You've had a suicide attempt at the age of 14. Mm. And and somewhere in your 20s, you're beginning to have very serious success. How do you reconcile the success with the other feelings, the conflicting feelings that would have caused you to do a suicide attempt? Was drinking the way that you reconciled things at that point?
Well, I don't think we have a lot to say with these conditions that we're given to deal with. I think that they're part of our chemical makeup, and that comes with any life. Success, you know, I don't care what you're doing. I mean, everybody claims that they can't stop drinking because, by the way, how could I not drink in my industry, quotes, whatever that industry might
right.
be. So whether you're a rock star or a television star or a housewife or, you know, a salesman, a car salesman, there are always excuses and reasons to drink, but it's not those that make you drink. If you have the disease of alcoholism, then you might wind up being an alcoholic. And if you have the consciousness to be diagnosed or to figure it out, you can have the option of recovery, because this is a disease, can be treated, and I was lucky I got into a
treatment
center.
Well, you may have a predilection for alcoholism, but I'm thinking that the reason that you would be addicted to anything, whether it's drugs, alcohol, chocolate, eating too much, whatever, fill in the blank, is that it's a way of anesthetizing. So if things are going too well, people anesthetize. If they're going too badly, people anesthetize. They just anesthetize not to feel in a lot of cases.
But not if they don't have the gene. Not if they don't have the thing.
They may not become the alcoholic.
I know people who can have a few drinks at lunch, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. And they won't drink again. And they're very stressed out over a situation. No, if you have, and you know if you have it, it can't be diagnosed outside of you. You have to surrender to it yourself, but you can get help. So with major eating disorders, it's a problem. It's a mental, emotional, physical, probably genetic problem. I think stress is a real sign of our times. I think we live in a tremendous stress. I'm not saying that I didn't have stress. Of course I had stress. But I also had that thing with which I could use another substance to dull the pain.
How did you kick your addiction?
I went into treatment. And I want to say 25 and a half years ago. I have to say that I'm sort of on a rampage about the insurance companies and what's happening in treatment, because insurance companies do not want to pay for treatment. And the whole push to put people in jail for addiction and things that happen during alcoholism, it's insane. It's insane. You look at my life. You know, I've had a productive, sober life experience for 25 years. I've been able to be part of the culture. I've made money for lots and lots and lots of people. I'm productive. I have a business. I employ people. I'm a success. Now if I were in jail for a car accident, or if I had committed a crime and I were in jail, I'm costing the country money. We need to think about treatment as the option for people with the diseases of alcoholism, drug addiction. We just have to. And the insurance company are behind it all. I mean, that's where the problem
They don't want to pay.
They don't want to pay, and the states don't want to pay. By the way, I'll tell you that I think Colorado is ahead of the game in terms of suicide. They're one of the only states, if not the only state, to have a state office for suicide prevention. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
And I think because we're talking about alcoholism now, and of course I had the good fortune to survive a lot of these addictions, but I also know that the issues of alcoholism, depression, drug addiction, mental illness are very much a part of the picture of the suicidal situation. I didn't write the book in a way as aimed to a prevention book. I wrote it to help the survivors of suicides, because the legacy is what I'm most disturbed about. That's where the secrecy lies, and I think that's where the solutions lie. Because if the survivors get on the horse and say, okay, we're going to start thinking in a holistic way about this and being truthful, maybe we can solve a lot of these problems.
My guest is Judy Collins. The book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. You can meet her tonight at Cherry Creek Tattered Cover, 7:30.
Oh, Danny boy.
Oh, that's nice.
The pipes, the pipes.
so good.
Calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the leaves are dying. It's you.
Side, get their side. Hear both sides talk on AM 1150 KNRC.
Ever wonder where your rent check goes each month? Other than into your landlord's pockets. Dream of buying a home of your own? Afraid to see what your credit report might say about you? Wonder how much truth is in the headlines. No money down. Buy for the same as rent. You know, how to buy a home isn't something that we're taught in school. But you can't avoid the school of hard knocks. Give me a call and get the facts. I practice power housing, empowering today's and tomorrow's home buyers with education, guidance, and support to make powerful home ownership choices. Power Housing with Sarah Harmon. www.powerhousing.com or give me a call at 303-475-0784. Again, 303-475-0784. Here comes the fine print.
Sarah Harmon is a licensed realtor and broker associate with Broker One Metro Properties. www.powerhousing.com or call 303-475-0784. Equal housing opportunity.
A KNRC community commitment.
The Curtis Arts and Humanities Center announces Live Art, an exhibit designed and coordinated by members of the Greenwood Village Teen Art Board. The exhibit features a 16-by-8-foot mural expressing the teens' outlook on today's art and a room of my own, utilizing objects from their homes. Located at 2349 Orchard Road in Greenwood Village, the Curtis Arts and Humanities Center offers a variety of art and admission is free. For hours and information, call 303-797-1779.
People are talking about AM 1150 KNRC.
I work in an office, and I listen to my favorite radio station every day.
I find out everything I need to know about what's going on.
I turn on my radio, I get all the information I need.
Whether it's Iraq or the stock market.
I listen in my car, I listen at work.
When news happens, you guys are on top of it.
You're my new best friend.
Just keep up the great work.
It's what we're here for. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC.
When I tune in,
I'm really pleased.
You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC.
Lionel, would you join me every weeknight from 9 to midnight here on AM 1150 KNRC? Now back to Enid Goldstein.
Sometimes I remember the old days when the world was filled with sorrow. You might have thought I was living. But I was all alone. In my heart the rain was falling, the wind blew, the night was calling. Come back, come back, I'm all you've ever known. Open the door and come on in. I'm so glad to see you, my friend. You're like a rainbow coming around the bend. And when I see you happy, well, it sets my heart free. I'd like to be as good a friend to you as you are to me.
Were you singing along with yourself?
Yeah,
you
sing along with yourself.
My guest is Judy Collins.
Through
I need
the
a go.
Haze, your smiles would greet me, saying okay, saying goodbye, saying hello. Yeah, I like to sing along with myself.
What a voice. Enid Goldstein, you're listening to the Tuesday edition of Enid Live. Judy Collins live with me in studio. Her new book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. She'll be at Tatter Cover Cherry Creek tonight at 7:30. You started out singing in Boulder.
I did.
1959.
I did.
Talk to me about the arc of your career, because, you know, we were talking in the break when Katharine Hepburn died. She died at the age of 94, 96. She'd had ups and downs, but she pretty much had a solid career.
Yeah.
For what, 70, 80 years?
Yeah.
Remarkable
yeah.
for any performer, particularly for a woman.
Particularly for a woman. And I was, you know, I guess I was a kind of a professional brat at the age of three or three and a half, because I was trotted out on the stage with my dad, who would sing. He went on tour with National School Assemblies in 1943, 1942. And I was in the car. I was the passenger. I got to sit back there and color and sing and carry on while my parents drove me around the Northeast. And my dad did concerts, and then he would have me come out on the stage. You know, I'd sing things like, you know, I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on me. And I got the idea that this is what I wanted to do. And then I started playing the piano. I studied classical piano. I learned the guitar. And by 1959, at the age of 19, I was starting my career in Boulder, Colorado, at the Michael's Pub.
Singing to
students mostly. But the ARC, you know, it's been extraordinary, because I had 24 years with Elektra. All those years during the war, I was making records. I was finding other writers, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen.
All right, now wait a minute. Did you know Marilyn Vandiver?
I was in high school with her. I was a year behind Marilyn.
She's married to the brother of a good friend of
you
mine.
You have to give her my love.
She's been on the show.
Such a brave woman and so strong and so wonderful. I have memories of Marilyn when I was in high school. I was an East High angel like Marilyn. Marilyn, I think, was the same class as Madeleine Albright. They were a year ahead
of me. Did you know Madeleine?
I didn't know Madeleine.
She was just on the program.
I know Madeleine.
Like
now.
A trifecta.
She's my friend, Madeleine, now. And I didn't bring her book. It's too heavy for the road, because I'm on the road and she's on the road. So I'm saving it to read at home. But I was at the book party. What a party, I'll tell you. But anyway, the ARC has been
so you started,
political.
The training was, because you have an extraordinary voice that remains extraordinary even though you are 64 years old.
Thank you. And
you look fabulous.
Thank you. And I look 37, don't I?
You do look 37. and 37 is my IQ. But,
yeah, that's right.
Or is it? What does somebody say?
53?
50, I said. Is that my IQ or my bust size? All right. What was the training for this voice?
The training was
this glorious instrument.
Twofold. First of all, I had incredible, fabulous training as a pianist with Brico here in Denver and with other teachers before that. I soloed with her orchestra here. I was working on the Rachmaninoff second piano concerto, you know, da 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 da. And then I found the guitar and started learning versions of the Blue Tail Fly, which she didn't like that at all. And then I had the guitar. I always played. I always sang. And when I hit New York, I already had been making records, three or four records, and I found my voice teacher. And I'm a born student. You know, that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, Sanity and Grace. I'm a born student. I love to study. And I studied voice for 32 years with Max Margolies until he died.
In New York. How did you get to New York from Boulder? Who found you? How did they find you?
Well, I kept working, and I came from Boulder. I came to Denver, and I sang at the Exodus, and people heard about me in Chicago, and I was hired there at the Gate of Horn. And from there, I went through all the coffee houses. In those days, there were wonderful coffee houses all over the country. And a folk singer, traditional singer, or somebody who wrote songs, could travel around the different towns and spent 2 weeks in Oklahoma at the Budai, or 2 weeks at the Purple Onion in Chicago, or go to Chicago, or rather in the West Coast, or go to Chicago and work the Gate of Horn. And I did that, and then I got through the clubs and through the connections. I did a television show at the Village Gate in New York, and Jack Holzman heard me and said, "You're ready to make a record." And that was 1961, rather. So I made my first record in 61.
All right, so from 59 to now is, what, about 24, 25 years? No, I've got that wrong. It's 40-some years.
It's
sorry.
44 years.
44 years.
It's 44
wow.
years.
My math is off. 44 years. So to keep...
My IQ, not my bust size.
Well, in my case, both are preceded by both a decimal point and a minus sign, but that's another story. So you go to the supermarket in the checkout line, and you see the people on the cover of People magazine. You have no idea who they are, and you don't have to memorize it either, because they're here and gone in 2 seconds. And yet you have maintained your career, a wonderfully thriving career, great success over all these years, a woman, and it's not easy to do for anybody, but particularly not for a woman. How did that happen? Other than part of it is fate and luck and all that other stuff, and part of it is terrific talent. But even so, a lot of people with great talent don't manage to do it. How did you manage to do it?
You know, I think that the training when I was a kid was fundamental. That's why I'm so enthusiastic about keeping the arts in schools. The training in the arts, my piano and my singing in the choir and my being part of the musical, schools and choruses and choirs and the culture. You know, I was part of Denver. I mean, I had a group in high school. We used to go out and sing for the PTA and the women's clubs and do all kinds of things. Being part of the fabric of the arts was what gave me my training. And the genes, of course. But how did it happen that
because some folk singing was a big thing in the 60s, maybe in the 70s, and then it went into eclipse, but your career didn't go into eclipse.
But I'm not a folk singer. I'm a singer. I'm a musician.
Right.
I'm a Judy Collins. You know, people meet me on a plane and they say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a Judy Collins. Because that's the kind of music I sing. It's based on what I always chose, what my personal choices were. I didn't sing only folk songs. I didn't sing only protest songs. And I kind of brought it together. I think the success for me is that somebody said to me, you know, I have to emphasize my accent. If I have an accent, it is that I know how to choose songs, that I write my own songs, I run my own business. I think that's also very important.
Well, you produced that film about your teacher, Antonio Grieco.
I produced and co-directed
You've written seven books.
I'm a workaholic.
Do you write song lyrics as well?
I write songs, many songs. So I've written songs. I've written books. I've recorded other people's songs. I've made 40 albums in these years. Part of it is running my own show. You know, I decided in 1973... that I wanted to know what was going on in my business. And before that, I didn't sign a check until I was 41 years old. Do you believe that? The first 20 years, I didn't sign a check.
I'm hoping not to sign any more checks myself. But I don't think you mean it in the same way.
But learning to sort of run the business and wanting to be a part of all of it and wanting to have control over what I do and make decisions about what I do. I think it's important to have an idea of where you want to go and then do your utmost to get there. And it takes a lot of discipline.
My guest is Judy Collins, the new book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to Enid Live on AM 1150 KNRC.
Imagine that this blue Danube waltz was a photo created by an ordinary printer. Nice, but add a little water, and the color would run, leaving things a bit muddy. Not so when you use an Epson all-in-one. Because only Epson uses exclusive DuraBrite inks for photos that actually resist damage from water on all paper types. So not only will this Danube start off blue, it'll stay that way. To learn more about brilliance that lasts, visit Epson.com.
Starting at around $149, the Epson Stylus CX5400 and CX6400 all-in-ones make perfect holiday gifts for all. Come see them, along with Epson's complete line of DuraBrite products, at Office Max.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Looking for love in all the wrong places? Try the Max Fund Animal Adoption Center, located at 1025 Galapagos Street. The Max Fund is the only no-kill shelter in the Denver area for injured animals with no known owners. They have numerous loving cats and dogs available for adoption, and also offer low-cost spays and neuters. To find a friend or volunteer your time, call 303-595-4917 or go to www.maxfund.org.
This week on Colorado State of
Mind. The Emmy-winning series takes a look back at some of the hottest topics of 2003. Television is becoming more violent and vulgar every day. What started as a cable trend toward programs featuring sex, violence, and explicit language is now a common thread on broadcast networks as well. And it's not just late-night TV. Reality, gross-outs, and bed-hopping 20-somethings are common at all hours. Has television gone too far? Or should viewers take responsibility for what they watch? Also, should the church allow homosexuals to serve as members of its clergy? And what about the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay? Should we be allowed to hold people indefinitely without charging them with some crime? Join host Greg Dobbs as he and a diverse panel of guests debate the issues on Colorado's State of Mind Friday night at 8:30 on Rocky Mountain PBS Channel 6. And join the discussion online anytime at rmpbs.org. Watch Colorado's State of Mind every Friday at 8:30 p.m. only on Rocky Mountain PBS.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
On Thursday, January 15th, the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame will be hosting a fundraising and book signing event showcasing 12 Colorado authors. The event will be held at the Colorado Business Bank located at 17th and Champa Streets from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Meet the authors, including Marilyn Vanderburg Atler and Dottie Lamb. For tickets and information on the Colorado Book Authors Signing Event Thursday, January 15th, call 303-423-2315. That's 303-423-2315.
Dr. Yuki hosts the exciting The Wild and Wacky World of Pets and Animals, airing live Saturdays at 2 p.m. on KNRC. The show is a zany, fast trip into the hilarious and fascinating world of animals. Learn unusual facts about the critters with which we share our world. Callers can win prizes during the Pet Trivia Challenge, and lots of fun is in store. Don't miss the fast-paced, action-packed hour of fun and hilarity with Dr. Yuki and The Wild and Wacky World of Pets and Animals, Saturdays at 2 on KNRC.
You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. Our contact number, 303-382-1150.
We hear you.
303-382-1150. Close is your phone. 303-382-1150. KNRC.
Ice cream castles in the air, feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, and now they only block the sun.
The singer of that song sitting in my studio, Judy Collins, her new book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival, and Strength. Can I tell you, I'm embarrassed to tell you this.
What?
But on the basis of that song, I enrolled in a class in Old Town in Chicago, got a guitar, a songbook, and sounded dreadful. But I was hoping to sound like you.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
The birds fled when I sang. In large numbers. All right, let's go to the phone. Lita calling from Bennett. Hi, you're live with Enid and Judy Collins on AM 1150 KNRC.
Hi, I just wanted to say hi to you. I met you in 1950.
Oh, my.
It was at your dad's radio show.
Oh.
In those days, Enid, they did live radio.
With audiences.
As opposed to what we do now, which is dead radio.
Consolidated radio.
Have recordings. But her dad used to play the piano, and I don't even remember why I was there. It's been so long, but it was a pleasure to meet you then. And
In 1950, how old were you?
I was 10.
10 years old. And you remember this, Lita?
Huh?
You remember this 10-year-old, this precocious 10-year-old with a big voice?
I thought he was older. I thought you were about 15.
Oh, no, I wasn't that old. Not in 1950.
Well, you were very...
That would make me way beyond what I am now, otherwise.
And I want to tell you, My favorite song that you do is Amazing Grace.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
And, you know, he knew that Amazing Grace was on the top 40.
Yep,
they
sure
were,
was.
And that just seems
not, it's so, not often that a hymn makes the top 40.
No,
it's not.
This was in late 1970s.
A hymn by her.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you, thank you for calling.
Lita, thank you very much.
Lita. Well, you're welcome.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you for talking with me.
I wanted to say something about Amazing Grace. My grandmother taught me the song, and when I recorded it, I did it with a bunch of friends at St. Paul's Chapel on the Columbia campus in New York City, and we recorded it there. And you know, it was on an album called Whales and Nightingales. And in those days, you didn't think about, well, what's going to be a hit? Or is this going to be a hit? I just made good music. I just tried to put together on the album songs that would make sense and I loved. And later on, and it became an enormous hit here and in England, and it was immediate, it was instant, it was such a surprise to hear that on the radio, a cappella singing. And I didn't know this until I read Steve Turner's recent book about Amazing Grace, that apparently in 1970-71, when this song came out, the song had sort of fallen out of favor. You know, it was written in 1784 by John Newton.
It just so happens that we have some Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like
sing the harmony or the melody or another song altogether, if you like, because it really is the spirit that counts. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
How old were you when you did that song?
I was in my early 30s, and apparently this song, according to Steve Turner, the recording of this song re-stimulated a worldwide interest in the song, and people began to record it in droves. There are now hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of recordings of the song. It even came into the repertoire of the bagpipers through a recording that was made in Scotland, the Scottish bagpipes, based on my version with the same harmonies. And it's a funny publishing story because actually I own the publishing on the bagpipes version.
You do?
Which I won in court. Isn't that interesting? In England.
Really?
Yes.
Did somebody sue you? Or did
publisher sued.
Filched your version.
They filched my version. Isn't that funny? But as a result, it came into the repertoire, and now you hear it everywhere. And I was very happy to have been a part of that process, because it's a very important song. It carries another legacy, which is interesting. John Newton was a slave captain of a slave ship in 1784, and he had a shipwreck, and he lived through the shipwreck. And after that, after living through it, he wrote the song, and then he devoted himself to the abolition of slavery and wrote hymns for the rest of his life. It's a nice story.
What's remarkable, a few years ago, I interviewed Dave Brubeck, and I did it because I was living in San Francisco, and I was in a recording studio doing my commentaries. And all of a sudden, an entourage of people walk in, and I'm looking at them, and one I recognize was Carmen McRae. And she was coming in to record the only album she ever did with Cal Tjader.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at Coast Recorders in San Francisco in an area laughingly known as wine country. For the people sitting on the curbs and the broken bottles.
Oh, dear.
And I managed to, Carl Jefferson was producing the album, and I managed to sort of scroll away, and I wrote a piece about it. And watched them. And then a few months later, unexpectedly, Cal Tjader died.
Yes.
And Dave Brubeck came to the Great American Music Hall, then in San Francisco, to do a memorial service. And the first song was don't get around much anymore, which I thought was pretty good. But I asked him about, and I was surprised, and I shouldn't have been surprised, but I think it was a mark of my own naivete, to talk about the business of doing what he did of jazz. And he said that really the most fun he had was when he got on stage, but that the most of his day was spent with the business of the bookings, the personnel, all that other stuff. Now, here you are. You've managed to be sort of a creative engine, and sometimes it comes out in the form of a book. Sometimes it comes out in the form of a film. Sometimes it comes out in the form of performing your music. What is a day consist of? I mean, there's got to be a lot of administrative stuff. Are you doing your own arranging, for example? Do you arrange your own material?
Well, it all depends. I always know what I want in a song, and I have a musical director with whom I work. So my day consists of a lot of things. Meditation, getting on the phone, working with my office, working with the structure of what the year's going to be like.
You're on tour how many days a year?
About 80 shows a year, something like that, which really means 160 and a lot of airplanes and a lot of hotels and all of that. But, of course, I have a wonderful staff who does that. I have a wonderful musical director. I try to put in some time writing. If I'm writing a book, of course, I'm working on that. I'm doing my editing. Having a social life, I'm married to a wonderful man, so I try to keep that
who
up.
Who are you married to?
I'm married to Lewis Nelson, who is an industrial designer. He's the guy who designed the Korean Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. on the mall. He's writing a book right now, too, about Memorial, called Memorial. And so we have our social life, we have our friends, but we both find ourselves at 1 o'clock in the morning still doing emails and doing business. I mean, it is a huge job to run the business and to have the career and to be creative, but I can't help myself.
But look at the challenges you've had. Alcoholism, whatever the addictions were, the suicide of a son that has to really put a hole into your heart. An immense gift that you've managed, and to whatever the obstacles are, you've managed to handle them as they have come up. Even you said bulimia for 11 years. You've managed to handle them as they've come up, to untangle the threads, and now you sit before us with a remarkable career, a remarkable life, and you look to me like a beacon of light, Judy Collins.
Well, I feel that way. I feel so blessed because it all has, you were saying about before about how it's very rare to be able to have a career where there are so many threads that come together in different kinds of creativity. And that's what I worked so hard for. And I realized that a lot of my 30s, in spite of all the other things that were going on, my 20s and 30s were really involved in knocking down those walls of prejudice and of my own imposed societal lack of permission to be that person that I wanted to be, fighting with producers, fighting with record companies, fighting with the business, to do something that I wanted to do my way. I can't tell you how hard I used to fight with record producers to make me sound like me. And my husband, Lewis, when Lewis and I got together in 1978, and I went out on the road that year with 17 people in my entourage. And he said to me at one point, he said, they come to hear you. They didn't come to hear the band. And, it was the smartest thing anybody said to me. I used to say, oh, well, they don't do that. This is the music business. He said, why not? This is your business. This is your life. You make it yours.
Judy Collins, thank you so much for joining us today. The book, Sanity and Grace, A Journey of Suicide, Survival and Strength. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to Enid Live on AM 1150.
My funny Valentine.
Oh, I love that song. It's so good.
Sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art.
Get your side, get their side. Hear both sides talk on AM 1150 KNRC. Don't settle for half the talk. Hear both sides talk on AM 1150 KNRC. The KNRC Community Commitment.
Looking for love in all the wrong places? Try the Max Fund Animal Adoption Center, located at 1025 Galapago Street. The Max Fund is the only no-kill shelter in the Denver area for injured animals with no known owners. They have numerous loving cats and dogs available for adoption, and also offer low-cost spays and neuters. To find a friend or volunteer your time, call 303-595-4917 or go to www.maxfund.org. Cut through snow and ice easier than ever. Visit your local BMW dealer and ask about the all-wheel drive 3 Series sedans and wagons, X5 and the new BMW X3.
You're listening to the award-winning AM 1150 KNRC. We've been honored by the Colorado Broadcasters Association with 4 awards of excellence and by the Associated Press with 7 awards for excellence in news coverage, including one for Best Radio Newscast in Colorado, plus Westward named Greg Dobbs, Denver's Best Radio Talk Show Host. KNRC is the youngest station in Colorado to achieve these prestigious honors. The award-winning AM 1150 KNRC. Talk to Greg Dobbs.
Okay, here's real justice. Unmitigated, genuine, obvious, don't argue with me justice. This guy in Tucson yesterday goes up to a Salvation Army setup, and the woman who is volunteering is in a wheelchair herself. She has cerebral palsy. She's 60 years old. This guy comes up, grabs the pot. She struggles with him. He runs with the pot, crosses the street, gets hit by a car.
There is justice out there.
Boy, yes.
Greg Dobbs, weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
2:59. We just have a few seconds left, so a lot of people to thank. Thank you to Judy Collins for coming in today. Thank you, Joe Anderson, for producing a fine show. Thank you, Jordan Lyles, for wonderful work on the board today and keeping us on the air tomorrow. We're going to be joined by Bill Clinton's biographer, David Marinus. On Thursday, Twyla Tharp. Doug Kellett up next from 3 to 6, 6 to 9, Dominic and Billy. I'm Enid Goldstein. I want to thank all of you who called and who listened. You know what? Try to leave a world a better place than you found it. Do something generous tonight, and I'll see you back here tomorrow, noon to 3, right here on
KNRC 1150. The KNRC Community Commitment.
The Ronald McDonald House offers comfort, hope, and love by providing a home away from home to out-of-town families receiving medical treatment for their children. They could use your help with donations of non-perishable food items and assistance with meal preparation. Both groups and individuals are needed for volunteer programs. If you can help, please call the Ronald McDonald House at 303-832-2667 or go online to ronaldhouse.org.
When you need to know.
I know.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
There's only one place to go.
Yeah, I know.
I do.
I do, too.
Get in the know.
It's what I need to know.
Information you need to know on AM 1150 KNRC. People are talking about AM 1150 KNRC.
It's a busy world, and none of us has a lot of time, especially me.
The station you can depend on.
They're going to give me all the headlines that's going on around the country, around the globe. That's why we use this station.
AM 1150 KNRC. The KNRC Community Commitment.
Have you been considering adoption? There are numerous children in Adams County who need adoptive families. Make a child's dream come true in the new year and foster or adopt a child from Adams County. You do not need to live in Adams County to participate. Call them now at 303-412-5151. That's 303-412-5151. Make your New Year's resolution to fulfill a child's dream and be an adoptive parent for Adams County.
Talk to Enid Goldstein.
Kudos again, Enid, for getting these Republicans so riled up. I can't believe they get
You should
riled
see
up.
My emails. Here's Robert. Here's the heading of his email. You are an idiot. I love KNRC, but you are the worst on-air host I have ever heard in my life. I have listened to you many times, and you are the most close-minded, hateful, idiotic person I have ever heard.
Well, see, that shows that you're really getting to them. They're ruffling their feathers.
Enid Goldstein, weekday afternoons from noon to 3 on AM 1150 KNRC. Talk to Bill O'Reilly.
Kofi Annan, head of the United Nations, Secretary General, who is a confused man above all else. Not a bad man, confused, ineffective. He's a PR guy, but he can't run that organization. Nobody could. He doesn't want to give Saddam the death penalty. It's not congratulations to the USA, and all of the United Nations applauds America for the sacrifice of the American military who have been killed. No, no, no. Oh, no. None of that. No, we just can't give him the death penalty. So, you know, Kofi, you can stop it with all due respect.
Bill O'Reilly, weekday mornings from 10 till noon on AM 1150 KNRC. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150, KNRC, Inglewood, Denver. Enid Goldstein continues straight ahead. It's 1 o'clock.
Network News, I'm Jackie Becerra. An interruption for some travelers in London. British Airways has canceled one of its daily flights from London to Washington. It is the same flight that was held on the tarmac when it arrived at Washington Dulles Airport yesterday. Correspondent Jack Garland reports from London.
They're saying only that it was following security advice from the government, and the government itself, specifically the Department of Transport, is saying that they cannot comment on matters of security or whether the cancellation was due to a specific threat. And that's all we have.
Two people are presumed dead after a small plane crashed into a Dallas neighborhood this morning. Two homes caught fire after the crash, but no one on the ground was hurt. It crashed shortly after takeoff from a local airstrip in rainy, foggy conditions on a flight to Amarillo. Two house fires in Ohio have killed six people. Firefighters say a woman and her three sons died early this morning. Then less than 20 miles away in Youngstown, two people died in a fire. Investigators don't yet know the cause of either fires. It's all rosy in Pasadena, California. The annual Rose Parade was held, and hundreds of thousands of people attended despite the cold weather. Correspondent Laura Wides on the parade route reports there's something for everyone.
We just saw an almost lifelike statue of President Lincoln, like the one that's in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial. We're about to see the Tower of Terror. A 100-foot depiction of a Disney ride that's under construction at California Adventure Theme Park.
White says this year there were several floats with patriotic themes, and those floats got the biggest reaction from the crowd. John Edwards' name may not appear on Rhode Island's primary ballot. The Democratic presidential candidate apparently didn't collect enough valid signatures. State election officials say only 918 of the signatures were valid. This is AP Network News. Questions of corporate regulation are surfacing in Italy after the bankruptcy of the Parmalat dairy giant. Correspondent Nicole Winfield reports from Rome.
It has increased calls for greater oversight of Italian companies just to give more teeth to Italian regulators so that they can impose sanctions and really go after Italian companies and make sure their books are right and are being fair to their investors.
Parliament has been wrapped in scandal with allegations of crudely forged bank documents and losses hidden offshore in the Cayman Island accounts. The man who took Parliament from a small salami and preserves company to a global billion-dollar powerhouse is now in prison in Milan. A delay in Afghanistan's landmark constitutional convention. The meeting in Kabul has been adjourned until Saturday after dozens of delegates refused to take part in a vote on several amendments to the proposed constitution. Survival stories are helping rescue workers in Iran continue their work. There are amazing survival stories from last week's earthquake that killed tens of thousands of people. John Schenck, a spokesman for the Christian humanitarian organization World Vision, is in BAM.
One's got to believe that God is involved. It has to be a miracle because it's been a number of days since the earthquake, and it is cold here. I'm pacing around in a parking lot right now in a deep winter parka. Talking to you. It's amazing those people survived all those nights.
Three more survivors have been pulled from the rubble, including a man who spent nearly 7 days buried under a flattened house. Today is a national day of mourning in Iran. In Iraq, The toll from last night's explosion at a restaurant in Baghdad has risen. Our correspondent Lotus Navarro is in Baghdad.
A deadly car bombing at a popular Baghdad restaurant has left 8 people dead and 35 more injured. As rescue workers tried to look for survivors overnight, more bodies were found beneath debris, raising the death toll. The U.S. military says the car that exploded next to Nabil restaurant as a New Year's Eve party was underway was packed with 500 pounds of explosives. The blast collapsed half of the building and ripped through neighboring apartment blocks. It has also raised fears in an already tense capital of more attacks to come on soft targets. Among those injured were 3 reporters from the LA Times and 5 of its local staff members. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
During England's mad cow outbreak in the 1980s, throngs of Britons gave up meat. But since the discovery of an infected cow in the United States, American vegetarians mostly have been careful not to take advantage of a situation that could cost lives and cripple a $40 billion industry. The year starts off with a bang for congressional lawmakers. Lawmakers still have to pass 7 of the 13 spending measures to run the government for the fiscal year that began 3 months ago. I'm Jackie Vishera, AP Network News.
I'm Stephanie DeLuca with the KNRC forecast from the Weather Channel. Starting up first day of 2004 with lots of sun, just a few clouds, topping out at 54. Later on tonight, partly cloudy down to 25. And tomorrow, mirror of today, lots of sun, just a few clouds at 54. But for Saturday, the clouds roll in. Chance of snow showers, cooler, high of 25. For the Weather Channel, I'm Stephanie DeLuca on AM 1150 KNRC.
Talk to Doug Kellett.
Watching the news, Thanksgiving Day, Bush is in Iraq, and I could hear the indigestion that was occurring in the stomachs of a lot of my friends on the left here who were getting all upset. We were sitting around watching this, and of course, I'm enjoying all of it. And it was funny, we're sitting there, and I'm like, well, how long will it be? How long will it take before, you know, our Democratic friends will be jumping all over this? He's the commander-in-chief. He left us with Dick Cheney.
Doug Kellett, weekdays from 3 to 6 on AM 1150 KNRC.
Store up on great holiday gifts this week at Pep Boys. Like a twin tank 4.6-gallon air compressor. Right now, just $89. At Pep Boys, you'll find plenty of new and exciting products. Like a gas-powered chopper-style scooter for just $3.99. And for a limited time, get a free $50 Pep Boys shopping card when you buy 4 select Futura tires. See Pep Boys ad in Sunday's paper for details and more unbelievable values. Pep Boys, we're car people.
In a perfect world, you'd never be short of holiday wrapping paper, especially while wrapping gifts at midnight on Christmas Eve. But the world isn't perfect, so there's Walgreens. Open late, many 24 hours, and right around the corner, with the gift wrap and tape you need to get in and out and on with wrapping your gifts perfectly. That's life. This is Walgreens.
Through Saturday, selected designer fragrance gift sets are 50% off Walgreens' everyday low price.
People are talking about AM 1150 KNRC.
I work in an office, and I listen to my favorite radio station every day.
I find out everything I need to know about what's going on.
I turn on my radio, I get all the information I need.
Whether it's Iraq or the stock market.
I listen in my car, I listen at work.
When news happens, you guys are on top of it.
You're my new best friend.
Just keep up the great work.
It's what we're here for. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC.
When I tune in,
I'm really pleased.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
On Thursday, January 15th, the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame will be hosting a fundraising and book signing event showcasing 12 Colorado authors. The event will be held at the Colorado Business Bank located at 17th and Champa Streets from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Meet the authors, including Marilyn Vanderburr Atler and Dottie Lamb. For tickets and information on the Colorado Book Authors Signing Event Thursday, January 15th, call 303-423-2315. That's 303-423-2315.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Are drugs affecting you, your family, or a friend? Narcanon provides answers to drug addiction. They offer free assessment and referral services to over 11,000 treatment centers nationwide. For 30 years, Narcanon has successfully used a drug-free approach to long-term recovery that works. They understand the cravings, guilt, and depression associated with addiction. To find out more about Narcanon, log on to www.stopaddiction.com or call 1-800-468-6933.
Dr. Yuki hosts the exciting The Wild and Wacky World of Pets and Animals, airing live Saturdays at 2 p.m. on KNRC. The show is a zany, fast trip into the hilarious and fascinating world of animals. Learn unusual facts about the critters with which we share our world. Callers can win prizes during the Pet Trivia Challenge, and lots of fun is in store. Don't miss the fast-paced, action-packed hour of fun and hilarity with Dr. Yuki and The Wild and Wacky World of Pets and Animals, Saturdays at 2 on KNRC.
You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
2:07, 7 minutes after 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Enid Live. I'm yours until 3 o'clock. And with me in this segment is Ann Garrels. If you have watched NBC News a while back, if you listen to NPR, you will know all about Ann Garrels. She is, a sort of roving foreign correspondent for NPR's foreign desk. Her new book is called Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War as Seen by NPR's Correspondent. She's going to be at the press club tomorrow for a BookBeat luncheon. You don't have to be a member of the press club. It's noon. If you're not a member, it's $18. If you are a member, it's $15. She's going to be at Tattered Cover tonight, Cherry Creek, at 7:30. Ann Garrels, I'm delighted that you could join us today. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be in Denver. I don't often get to nice places.
Well, the reason that I have a real interest in meeting you and in this book is some months ago during the thick of the war, Jake and Suzanne Page were in as guests, and for people who didn't listen to that program or who don't know who they were former editors and photographers at the National Geographic, and they have written wonderful, wonderful books, and one I reviewed zillions of years ago, a book on Hopi, right as I was running away to live with the Hopi Indians, never mind that none had invited me and I knew none, but one an old lady who took me in on Walpi. Anyway, here they were coming through town, and I was really eager to meet them because I had so loved their book on Hopi. They'd also written a book about Navajo, and we did the interview, and then in a break or afterward, there was a news report talking about the fighting in Iraq, and it was hard to get food, and then they started to talk about how you were their friend, and that they were very worried for you, that nobody could get to you, that there was couldn't get food. They were very worried about whether you'd be coming back alive or not. And I never forgot that. And as soon as I saw that you were going to be in Denver, I thought, we have to have you on. I want to hear the story. You are one of a handful of non-embeds. Explain what that means.
Well, basically, there had been a lot of us in Iraq. I went a year ago. And was there on and off up to the war. There were hundreds of journalists. And then as the clock ticked down to the bombing, the couple of weeks before the bombing, a lot of people began to get cold feet, or their editors got cold feet.
Now, you cover a lot of hot spots. You've been in Chechnya. You've been in Afghanistan. Where else? Bosnia?
Bosnia. Unfortunately, you name it. Since I didn't start out as a war correspondent. I mean, I got into this whole thing with a passion for the former Soviet Union and Russia, and I speak Russian, and that's where I spent a lot of the early years, and covering a very cold war. And
come close to the microphone, because it's one of those kinds of microphones.
And I was covering, as I say, a very cold war. And then in 1991, when the former Soviet Union broke up, war started erupting everywhere in places most of us had never heard of, Abkhazia, Nagorno-Karabakh, near Armenia, you name it. So I ended up covering these places, Bosnia, Kosovo. And so inadvertently, I got to be, if you will, good at it. The editors at NPR asked me if I would go last October, and we knew that there was pretty certain that there would be a war eventually.
Go to Iraq. They wanted
to go to Iraq, exactly, and with the full expectation that there would be a war. But none of us talked about whether or not I would actually stay for the war. And my bosses were like most. They began to get cold feet as the clock ticked down and wanted to pull me out, and I wanted to stay. And it was very hard to persuade them that I was sure I would be all right, because I wasn't sure, but I was But my gut told me I would. I've been there many months, and I had a remarkable Iraqi who worked with me. He had initially just been my driver and, morphed into something far more than that. And I had a little, that gave me confidence. And frankly, the bombing was never that much of an issue. We knew, we'd seen it in 91 and 98, and it was even more accurate this time. And in fact, the infrastructure was not damaged badly by the bombing. It was very targeted to Saddam's palaces, security installations, military installations.
So you were there in the Gulf War?
Yes. Well, I was in Saudi Arabia in the Gulf War. Most of us were not in Iraq. And in fact, I mean, in the Gulf War, only CNN was allowed to stay in Baghdad by the Iraqis. This time the Iraqis, they were very ambivalent about whether they really wanted the press to stay or not. But they were playing to a different audience this time. They were playing to an anti-war audience in Europe and in the Arab world. You know, there wasn't the great coalition that there had been in 91.
So you as a woman, did you find any particular hassles in that regard? Although Iraq was considered pretty liberal.
Yeah.
Women could have professions there. They didn't have
to wear
the chador or burqa or whatever. Every culture calls it something else.
It's become more conservative, but nonetheless, just as you say, I mean, Iraqi women hold jobs, go to university, they're mixed. Saddam's initial revolution had been secular, although he then sort of took the mantle of Islam to justify his continued rule.
How many months had you been there? So now you're there, you go in what, October?
I go in October.
And you're there until...
On and off.
On and off. You come back and forth
because
you're married, but you come,
right.
You come back and forth.
And also, the Iraqis wouldn't let us stay for endless periods of time. They would sort of throw you out, and then you'd have to reapply for a visa. It was a way to control the press.
Okay.
And make you behave so that you would get another visa.
And in other words, if you didn't toe the line in some way, you couldn't get another visa to come back.
Yeah, well, a lot of press in the end pulled their punches precisely because of that in order to keep getting visas. I figured it just wasn't worth it. If I wasn't telling the truth, I could get the press conferences on the internet. I mean,
right.
What the hell was I doing there if I wasn't doing as much as I possibly could? So getting visas was not always easy, but luckily, Iraqi officials have become so corrupt that for a certain sum, you could usually, buy one, in essence. It wasn't guaranteed, but lo and behold, in March, I bought a visa from the Iraqi ambassador in Amman, Jordan. I had not been
How
issued
much did one. It cost you?
It cost $1,000.
My guest is Ann Garrels. You hear her on NPR, the book Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War, as seen by NPR's correspondent. Okay, so you buy a visa, and now this is, when did we go in?
So
March,
I'd been going back and forth, and I go in March. And so then we've got about a couple of weeks before the bombing, before President Bush's deadline in jest. It's all right for you, but I'll have to write the eulogy if anything happens.
Oh.
They were scared for me. And it's very hard. I was there, and I was really running on gut as much as anything else, but I've been doing this for 25 years. I mean, it wasn't like I just was going, oh, I think it'll be all right. So, but then when we looked around one day, I mean, it just was the hours. It was, about 8 hours before President Bush's deadline. We looked around and started counting heads and realized, whoops, there are only 16 of us left, 16 Americans. There were about 100 total. The networks had all sort of left in the middle of the night a couple of days before.
They pulled their people out.
I mean, they pulled their people out, and it was the most extraordinary group. It was the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker, NPR, and the major newspapers.
That was it.
And it was a great group of people, and we all looked after each other, and we didn't work together because you really had to, in order to skirt the authorities and elude Saddam's minders and security forces, you had to sort of be wily. And so you didn't work in a group particularly. But we saw each other every day at the infamous press conferences, or should I say the press conferences by the infamous information minister.
Baghdad Bob.
He was known here. We didn't call him that. We didn't think he was as funny as people here did, because he had our fate in his hands, and he was a really nasty piece of work. He had been with Saddam from the very beginning. He had been part and parcel of the worst of what the regime did. And while it was pretty absurd, and I think the most absurd moment was when he, you know, he, as the American troops had, were approaching the edge of Baghdad and were without question at the airport, and we could hear, it was no longer just bombing, we could hear small arms fire as there was immediate combat between the Iraqis and the Americans. And, of course, Baghdad Bob, as you know, was sitting there saying, they're not there. You know, it's all Disney. I mean, it's all just illusion. It's all the Americans are just using stage sets to pretend they're at the airport. To which point, one clever journalist in the group said, well, if that's the case, can we go to the airport? And he said, but of course. At which point, every Iraqi official in the room turned a very strange shade of green because they knew that what was really going on. They knew the Americans, you know, were at the airport, and they knew that, I mean, they didn't want to go there. They didn't want to die. And so afterwards, you know, they're going, you can't leave the hotel. You can't go there. What are you, out of your mind? You know, I mean, it was completely surreal.
You were at the Al-Rashid?
Well, I
Where did you
used
stay?
To live at the Al-Rashid in the early days, but when the war came, they moved us all to the Palestine Hotel. The Al-Rashid was a potential target because it has a very large bunker underneath it. So none of us wanted to stay there, although it is was the best hotel.
Were you confident that our that we knew that you were at the Palestine Hotel?
Yes, there
Palestine
was no question.
Hotel.
The coordinates of the hotel and everything had by the news organization, all the major news organizations.
They had worked that out with the Pentagon.
They had told the Pentagon.
That now, this you is know, where we are. I don't, and, but that doesn't mean that there can't be a mistake.
Right, and there subsequently was a mistake when right. the Pentagon shelled the hotel and killed two friends of mine, three flights above me.
Oh. So here you are in this hotel, and now the war starts for real. What describe what has happened. Is it that you start to hear rumblings, you start to hear the fire at the airport, or does it come in like rolling thunder, or what happened?
Well, to start with, it was just
And what
it was
notice
the bombing.
Do you have?
I mean,
did you get any notice at
no,
all?
No, no, but we knew what the deadline was, and it the president's deadline was 8 o'clock in the evening, East Coast time, and which was about 4 in the morning my time, 4 or 5 in the morning. And I stayed up all night. I couldn't sleep, obviously, waiting for this to happen. And we suddenly heard anti-aircraft guns and flares going up all over the city. We couldn't hear any incoming bombing to start with, but we heard, you heard something in the distance. It was very hard to make a distinction between what was outgoing and what might have been incoming. And then it got... So it was very noisy and a lot of flares, and then it got very quiet. We all then ran to the information ministry when it was light to find to see if Saddam was, you know, going to say anything about the beginning of the war had come. Officials were obviously, you know, panicked. And once again, I can only use the word surreal because you knew that this was, they knew this was the end, that the war had started, and this time the Americans were not going to stop at the border. They were going to come in. They would take Baghdad. Question was, what would the fight for Baghdad really be like in the end? The bombing was one thing, but when it came in on the ground, what was it going to be like? And for us, the question was, how would Iraqi officials respond in the last paroxysm of panic? Would they, you know, take us hostage? And when I spoke earlier about my gut told me that these guys didn't have a stomach for a fight and that if they were going to do anything... they were going to go underground. You know, they would just disappear somewhere, you know, maybe go to Syria or go underground. And as we've now seen, they did, in fact, I mean, some units of some Saddam supporters have indeed gone underground, and they are amongst those who are attacking the American troops. But what was so important all along was listening to Iraqis. I mean, that was the whole reason I was there. And they so accurately predicted what we're seeing now. They predicted the looting. They predicted the security vacuum. They predicted that the society would break apart. They predicted the crime. They weren't so afraid of the bombing. They were afraid of the aftermath. And as we see, rightfully so.
A State Department report predicted that also
and
a
was
year
ignored.
Or two in advance, right, and was shelved and ignored by the president, right. Rumsfeld and the Pentagon. My guest is NPR's Ann Garrels. Her new book, Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War, as seen by NPR's correspondent. You can meet her tonight at Tattered Cover, Cherry Creek, 7:30. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to AM 1150, KNRC.
KNRC Community Commitment.
The Curtis Arts and Humanities Center announces Live Art, an exhibit designed and coordinated by members of the Greenwood Village Teen Art Board. The exhibit features a 16-by-8-foot mural expressing the teens' outlook on today's art and a room of my own, utilizing objects from their homes. Located at 2349 Orchard Road in Greenwood Village, the Curtis Arts and Humanities Center offers a variety of art and admission is free. For hours and information, call 303-797-1779.
People are talking about AM 1150 KNRC.
I work in an office, and I listen to my favorite radio station every day.
I find out everything I need to know about what's going on.
I turn on my radio, I get all the information I need.
Whether it's Iraq or the stock market.
I listen in my car, I listen at work.
When news happens, you guys are on top of it.
You're my new best friend.
Just keep up the great work.
It's what we're here for. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC.
When I tune in, I'm really pleased.
Community Commitment.
The Arvada Center for the Arts and Humanities presents the 14th Annual Cowboy Poetry Gathering, January 9th through the 12th. This four-day event features a lineup of 38 cowboys and ranchers from 14 states who will capture the spirit and lifestyle of the West through poetry, song, and verse. For hours, information, and to purchase tickets, visit the Arvada Center's website at www.arvadacenter.com or call 720-898-7200.
Get your side, get their side. Hear both sides talk on AM 1150 KNRC.
Hi, I'm Enid Goldstein. Get up close and personal with the Colorado Symphony in the only concert hall in America where the music literally becomes the center of attraction. The CSO is offering KNRC listeners 20% off tickets in the Parquet and Mezzanine 1 sections of Betcher Concert Hall for all Masterworks and Super Pops performances. These seats put you practically in the middle of the orchestra. You can watch the conductor's every move and hear the majesty and force of the music build before you.
Join the Colorado Symphony Orchestra and pianist Chris O'Reilly for a performance of Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 2 on January 9th, 10th, and 11th. This Masterworks performance includes Mozart and more. Tickets available at all King Supers Tickets West outlets and online at www.coloradosymphony.org.
And to get up close and personal with the CSO, call 303-893-4100. That's 303-893-4100.
KNRC Community Commitments.
Have you been considering adoption? There are numerous children in Adams County who need adoptive families. Make a child's dream come true in the new year and foster or adopt a child from Adams County. You do not need to live in Adams County to participate. Call them now at 303-412-5151. That's 303-412-5151. Make your New Year's resolution to fulfill a child's dream and be an adoptive parent for Adams County.
AM 1150 KNRC features more in-depth reporting than any other Denver talk station. Our in-depth reports have been recognized by the Colorado Broadcasters Association and the Associated Press for 4 awards of excellence. Hear in-depth reports from award-winning KNRC reporters Mark Roberts and Stacey Farb during the Greg Dobbs Morning Show or anytime at knrcradio.com where you can click it and own it. Denver's in-depth talk station, AM 1150 KNRC.
Hi, this is Doug Kellett. Brenda at Golden Triangle Wines and Spirits is here with me. And Brenda, I need your help about champagne. For example, I need some good bottles for gifts, an inexpensive one to drink with friends, maybe even an expensive case to throw a party or two.
Well, Doug, I've got sparkling wine and champagne to fit all three of those categories. I've got Paris Cuvée and Nicolas Feuillat, Paul Justine and Raja Colon, and Tino, all wonderful, under $30, in the $10 to $15 range, some Spanish Cavas. Cava is made like real champagne. They require them to use quality grapes, and they do real second fermentation. Alvino Cava, Marques de Galida. And then for toasts, I've also got an inexpensive cava for $6.49 a bottle called Marques de Monastrell. It's a wonderful bottle of wine, wonderful bottle of sparkling.
Wow, Brenda, I knew you'd have the right answer. Golden Triangle Wines and Spirits, convenient location, 12th and Broadway.
Golden Triangle Wine and Spirits, where variety, pricing, and convenience intersect at the corner of 12th and Broadway. Call 303-893-8437.
You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. Our contact number, 303-382-1150.
We hear you.
303-382-1150. Close is your phone. 303-382-1150. KNRC.
2:46 on the Wednesday edition of Enid Live. I'm yours until 3 o'clock. My guest in the studio, Ann Garrels, Naked in Baghdad, the Iraq War as seen by NPR's correspondent. You can meet her tonight at Tattered Cover, Cherry Creek at 7:30. And tomorrow at the Denver Press Club Book Beat Luncheon, she'll be the guest of honor. You don't have to be a member to go over there and have a fabulous lunch and meet a wonderful, talented correspondent who has gone through a lot to bring us these reports from Baghdad. Did you ever think, I mean, the real question I think I really want to ask you, Ann, was there ever a time when you thought that this might not come out as well as you were so certain it would going in? I mean, was there a time when it was so dangerous that you thought, what am I doing here? Why?
Well, one morning I woke up and four of my colleagues who had come in during the war, they weren't exactly part of the 16, four journalists who'd come in on with sort of tourist visas, would you believe? And they were journalists, and they were staying at the Palestine. And suddenly, one morning, we woke up, and they were gone. Any evidence of their existence had been removed from their rooms. And we weren't sure what had happened to them. We then found out that they had been detained by the security forces, but the Iraqis wouldn't tell us any more than that. We didn't know, and day after day after day went by, 8 days. Finally, they were deported to Jordan. They had been held and interrogated in Abu Ghraib prison. But they weren't tortured. They were treated okay.
Why were they interrogated?
Well, unclear. They came in on spurious visas. And they also, some of them had these very small satellite phones that looked like a cell phone. And the Iraqis were very nervous about these phones.
Why?
And they were freelancers for the most part. And so you can imagine the Iraqis putting it together and thinking, aha, these are spies. Because they thought with these little phones that they could be acting as spotters for the U.S. military. Because most of our sat phones were, you know, as I said, the size of laptops, and you have to unfold the antenna. And they're pretty noticeable. I mean, you can't sort of go out on the streets or whatever and use it without being seen. The Thurias, these little phones, they're not as good quality. They're not broadcast quality, but they're very useful. And the Iraqis were incredibly suspicious of these, and they were illegal in the country. You were not allowed to have them, but people did. And so I think quite possibly that's why they were detained and then subsequently expelled from the country. But it was really the aftermath which was worse. I mean, when the troops came in on the ground initially, you know, everybody thought it. You know, you saw the camera pictures of the statue coming down and people throwing flowers.
Were you there? Did you see it?
Oh, absolutely.
Was that sort of staged or was?
No, I mean, people were jubilant, but there were just as many people standing around in absolute shock and terrified of what was going to happen next. And they found the whole thing humiliating to be overrun by the Americans, even though they wanted an end to Saddam. A lot of conflicting emotions. And one man said to me that that day as the statue came tumbling down, we stood right there, and he said, you know, the Americans are now going to have to take complete control, and we will resent them every step of the way. And, of course, unfortunately, the Americans have not been able to take complete control.
It's a double bind. They have alienated their oldest allies and were so imperious in coming in to do this alone, there isn't much.
They haven't
that
alienated
in the way,
everybody yet. I mean, I wouldn't say that they've alienated everybody yet, but they've lost a lot of time. They made a lot of mistakes. There was, you know, the troops didn't have enough cultural training. They really had no idea what kind of a country they were.
And
going
there were
into.
No administrators coming in who had had experience with civilian
very few.
Situations.
Very few.
There were
who had
experience
coming. In the region, and so there were cultural mistakes made. For the military, it was a very difficult process of moving from being, you know, sort of a fighting force coming in to essentially being a police force with a shadowy enemy. That was a very difficult transition for the troops to make. And it's a very different kind of job. The raids that they did on Iraqi, you know, houses looking for Saddam hangovers, holdovers, were not always organized well, and a lot of civilians have been killed in the process. There was some real problems in the early months with checkpoints. The checkpoints weren't always visible. I know, and I mean, it's nearly happened to me, and I know a lot of humanitarian workers that you're driving along and you suddenly almost are running a checkpoint before you see it. And if you run a checkpoint, you're dead. They'll just torch the car. I mean, they'll just fry the car. People have died that way. And I've been in neighborhoods where, you know, innocent people got caught like that. And at the funerals, people who basically supported the U.S. to start with or were fence sitters, we're talking jihad, you know, holy war at the funeral. I don't know if that was just the heat of the moment and the passion of loss, and to what degree it really seriously has changed people's minds. But it, you know, it's had an effect. It's had an effect.
You have covered,
the bloom is off, let's put it that way.
You've covered a lot of hot spots, and this one, the most recent, and you want to go back.
Oh, yes.
How are you changed by having been in Iraq or covering some of these really these war-torn environments? And what observations do you have to make from having been up close to something we only hear about reported, you know, very, very far away from, you know, we're far away from what's going on? So you've been in these war environments now for a while, and the most recent Iraq, and you're going to go back. How are you changed, and what do you see?
Well,
that
I guess,
we don't see.
I mean, what I've seen, you know, let's just take, say, the war in Chechnya, which was probably the worst war by far that I've ever covered, in many, many ways. The Russians were, you know, just went in and carpet bombed the capital city, Grozny. The more civilian the target, the more attractive it was. The troops, in that case, the troops had no leadership. They were really left on their own. They had no training. They were chewed up and spat out. The casualties, the death rate was enormously high, not to mention for the civilians who, you know, as I say, were just mowed down. Grozny, the capital, doesn't even exist really now. It's been leveled, literally. I mean, it makes Nuremberg look like nothing. And to see initially the Chechens, you know, were... I mean, they wanted their independence. Yeltsin in 91 had told everybody, take as much independence as you could. And they took some independence. And then they were having second thoughts about it. There really had not been a very good process of negotiations. And the Chechens were always suspicious of the Russians after Stalin had deported the entire Chechen population in the 40s. And then finally they were allowed back in the 50s. I mean, their history was not great. And they were just beginning to get over what had happened 50 years prior. Previously, and begin to deal with the Russians when this horrible war ensued. And the Russians could have stopped the independence movement, I think. But when they were so brutal in this war, the Chechens then became radicalized. And now they are, I mean, I'm afraid, I won't go to Chechnya. It's much too dangerous. It used to be just the Russians. Now it's the Chechens. They're taking us captive. They're kidnapping. They're raping. They think that we are that we're part of the enemy. You know, they have become part of the people now that, you know, are called terrorists, radical Islamists and it happened so fast. And you see how opinions and attitudes can be changed overnight for the worst, but to make it better will take generations.
And Gerald, thank you so much for joining us. The book, Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War, as seen by NPR's correspondent. You can meet her tonight, Tattered Cover, Cherry Creek, 7:30. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to Enid Live on AM 1150, KNRC.
Most people come from one school of thought. Welcome to the beauty of both sides. AM 1150, KNRC.
This week on Colorado State of Mind, the Emmy-winning series takes a look back at some of the hottest topics of 2003. Television is becoming more violent and vulgar every day. What started as a cable trend toward programs featuring sex, violence, and explicit language is now a common thread on broadcast networks as well. And it's not just late-night TV. Reality, gross-outs, and bed-hopping 20-somethings are common at all hours. Has television gone too far, or should viewers take responsibility for what they watch? Also, should the church allow homosexuals to serve as members of its clergy? And what about the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay? Should we be allowed to hold people indefinitely without charging them with some crime? Join host Greg Dobbs as he and a diverse panel of guests debate the issues on Colorado State of Mind Friday night at 8:30 on Rocky Mountain PBS Channel 6. And join the discussion online anytime at rmpbs.org. Watch Colorado State of Mind every Friday at 8:30 p.m. only on Rocky Mountain PBS.
You're listening to the award-winning AM 1150 KNRC. We've been honored by the Colorado Broadcasters Association with 4 awards of excellence and by the Associated Press with 7 awards for excellence in news coverage, including one for Best Radio Newscast in Colorado, plus Westward named Greg Dobbs, Denver's Best Radio Talk Show Host. KNRC is the youngest station in Colorado to achieve these prestigious honors. The award-winning AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now, the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
2:24 on the Wednesday edition of Enid Live. I'm yours until 3 o'clock. With me in the studio, Ann Garrels from NPR, her new book, Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War as Seen by NPR's Correspondent. You can meet her tonight at Tattered Cover Cherry Creek at 7:30, and tomorrow at the Press Club, the Denver Press Club. You don't have to be a member. It's a BookBeat luncheon, and she will be the guest of honor at that luncheon. Her story is remarkable. When we last left each other, you're there. The invasion is underway. You get there around the beginning of March. You don't leave until the end of April, so you're there for roughly a couple of months. Your two good friends, Jake and Suzanne Page, who are being interviewed on my program, expressed to me their deep concern about the fact that you, hoping that you come out of this okay, because there are issues of food and water and so on. Is that,
well,
do I have that
okay.
Right?
Food was actually, the food wasn't very good. Most of the restaurants obviously had closed because of the bombing. But you could get food. That wasn't, it was, the water was a problem. In the middle of the war, the electricity went and water became scarce.
Could you call out? Did you have a phone?
I had a satellite phone. That was my means of communication. And the title of the book comes from the fact that the authorities kept trying to, I mean, they were ambivalent about really whether they wanted the press there. Initially, they wanted us all at the information ministry, which was clearly a target, and lo and behold, it was bombed. And I was not going to stay there. So I had smuggled my phone, the satellite phone, which is about the size of a laptop, to the hotel, and along as many other journalists had. And every now and again, in this sort of capricious way, the authorities would go around and confiscate cameras or sat phones or whatever. So I figured if I was naked in the dark, when the goons went down up and down the hallways, they would either not see the light under the door and think I wasn't there asleep, or if they did barge in some way or try and barge in, if I was naked, I could say, "Oh my God, you just woke me up! Please, you know, oh, modesty."
So you really? So
yeah,
you
modesty,
thought that would
modesty,
work?
Please.
And did they get you when you were naked?
And they left, and I managed to hide the phone I mean, I think they were so nonplussed by the whole thing, not because I was some gorgeous babe, but the, you know, more that, oh, it worked. I don't know. It worked. I mean, thank God I didn't have to use this ruse more than once, because I'm not sure how many times it would have worked. But, you know, desperate times call for desperate actions is all I can say.
All right. So the bombing is, when the Baghdad is bombed, how close to you did it feel?
Oh, it was really close.
It was, because in the news reports, it seemed like it was loud and it was horrible. And
it was very loud. And there were, it would come in waves that were, you know, profoundly, I mean, they were frightening, except that after very quickly, you got a sense of the accuracy. And there really was very little collateral damage. Some windows would be broken near the biggest bomb
sites. Did you
want to
be under something when they were bombing?
No,
or did you
I had
get
to
under
watch
the bed?
It so I could describe what was going on.
So where were you watching it from?
From my balcony, and the bombing was going on for the most part right in front of me. I was just across the river, I mean, maybe a couple of hundred yards from the Republican Palace, which was one of the biggest targets. And it was just, I literally saw a cruise missile go past my window and turn left.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I watched it. I thought I was crazy. I then had to run next door, and because there were some people who knew a great deal more about weapons than I next door, and I said, "Did I really just see what I think I saw?" But it was helpful that I was so busy trying to be as good and as observer as I could be, as good a witness as I could be, trying to talk to people about their feelings, about their attitudes towards the United States. You know, what damage there had or had not been. I mean, the Iraqis clearly wanted to, you know, say that, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of civilians were being killed, which was not the case. Many more civilians have been killed in the aftermath by the Americans than were killed, and by Iraqis in the chaos of the aftermath, than were killed during the war.
How is it that the Iraqis could see what was going to happen after during the occupation, that there would be looting, that there would be all kinds of problems? And how is it that the Pentagon was unable to see something that seemed so obvious, and furthermore shelved a report that the State Department had prepared more than a year before, predicting these very things, a report
Maybe
that
you
now
should
looks
have the defense Secretary
early
here.
Prescient. I don't think he's going to want to come. Not unless Mitch Dichter is here, who thinks he's a stud. I don't think he's coming.
I don't know. I mean, the Iraqis so clearly painted an accurate picture of what was to come. And in many ways, that's a problem that the U.S. is facing now, because they knew, and the Iraqis knew, and they've lost a lot of time and a lot of goodwill from the Iraqis, who say, you know, because it raises questions in Iraqi minds about what are really the U.S. intentions. Do they really care about Iraqis? Because Iraqis are just as American soldiers, but Iraqis, probably far more than American troops, are the victims in all of this.
I had a wonderful friend who died, and you might have known him. He was an editor for maybe U.S. News and World Report or a number of magazines like that. Nizar Jueda. He was an Iraqi, and he grew up, I mean, he was educated at the Sorbonne and in London, and the father, I think, had been a member of Parliament somewhere along mm-hmm. the line in the early, early days, before Saddam, I'm sure. Did you ever meet Saddam Hussein?
No. With the exception of Dan Rather, who did a very mealy-mouthed interview with Saddam, none of us were invited. In fact, he had not been seen in public for, I think it was actually, if maybe 2 years before the war.
Do you think he's still alive?
I think it's quite possible. There were many times when I was up in the Sunni Triangle, which is the area north of Baghdad, where support for Saddam still lingers. These are Sunni Muslims who had benefited by Saddam's rule, although they had also suffered. Many of them were recruited into the security forces and the Special Republican Guard. I went up there to interview people who were still nostalgic for the days of Saddam. And I got this feeling on many an occasion that Saddam could be in the room next door, quite possibly. I mean, certainly they would have protected him had he come.
My theory is that they ran out of black hair dye, and he's walking around as a natural. No one knows it's him.
That's probably true. After all, when you saw what his sons looked like when they were killed, and these sort of big, bushy beards. And then, of course, there are all the Saddam lookalikes. I mean, so, you know, then the conspiracy theories in Iraq are, you know, will you really know if you got Saddam anyway? So if you do get him.
Well, somebody who has a penchant for paintings on black velvet, possibly. Having spent so much time in Iraq, you now want to go back.
Oh, yes.
And you're not at all frightened of...
I'm concerned. I mean, I'd be a fool not to be. But, you know, I mean, unlike, say, NBC that was targeted a few weeks ago, I mean, they lived in a hotel that was flush to the street. It seems to me an absurd choice. And all of the television companies... British, American, I don't know about the others, I mean, have hired security companies to work for them.
And you're just going to go by yourself?
Yes. I mean, I don't think...
There's going to be you and the driver, or well, it used to be your driver, and no security, just the two of you.
Yes, because, I mean, I don't think security always helps. It can actually make you far more noticeable. It adds more bodies. You have to have bigger cars. I mean, in the case of NBC outside their hotel, there were regularly big black Toyota Land Cruisers sort of basically screaming, there is, you know, a big foreign operation here. So I stay in a remote, you know, hotel. Nobody, you know, doesn't look like anything in particular. I don't stay with all of the other journalists. I don't have a fancy car that draws attention. And I work alone with a translator and a driver.
You're a brave woman, Anne Gerolf. What was the net effect of what we achieved, if anything, in Iraq, other than the obvious, we did remove Saddam Hussein. But is it too early to assess what we have achieved?
I think it's much too early to assess at this point. But there is no question that the administration was not prepared for the aftermath. It was not prepared for the violence. It was not prepared for the ongoing casualties. It was not prepared to provide security for the entire country. 130,000 troops may sound like a lot, but it's not. I mean, it's far fewer per capita.
What's the population of Iraq?
Well, there hasn't been a census in a long time, but it's about, you know, it's a large territory, the size of California, and it's about somewhere between 25, 30 million people. And the borders are unprotected. People, I saw foreign fighters there from Syria, Algeria, Tunisia.
I've had Ahmad Rashid here on the show. I've had Marianne Weaver, who has covered the Middle East for decades and writes for The New Yorker. And both of them said the same thing, and this was before the run-up to the war, that if we were to go to war, it would act as a recruiting poster for every terrorist in the neighborhood and even not in the neighborhood, which is exactly what seems to have happened.
Yes.
How was it that the administration, when it seems so commonsensical to the rest of us, how did the administration not notice, how did they overlook this possibility? Bush quoted the other day as saying, it's the terrorists who are doing this. Like, duh.
I don't know. I mean, I can only describe what I saw on the ground. The civilian administration, when it first went in, my favorite question to people working there under Paul Bremer was, so when were you tapped to come in on this, you know, huge reconstruction job? And people would say, oh, May, June. Like, what?
Afterwards. Way after.
And most people were only coming in for a month or two, you know, sort of, and then rotating through. And so by the time they got a grip on a subject, they left. There were very few people initially who had any experience in the region. Bremer's offices were staffed. There were a lot of, you know, finding a building that was secure was very difficult. And finding accommodations for people to sleep. So jobs, you wanted people who were really good at their jobs and really, you know, valuable. And a lot of the people who were working in key positions around Bremer, taking up valuable desk space and bed space, were basically politicals sent in by Rumsfeld. And many officials said to me that, you know, what most of these people were doing was basically just sort of calling back to Rumsfeld. They really weren't doing anything useful. They were spies, really, for the Defense Department. And Bremer had a very difficult time staffing it with the right kind of people who had experience in Reconstruction. Clearly, the intelligent, there aren't enough people who are good at intelligence, who were able to get good intelligence on Iraq. The president acknowledged that yesterday, that intelligence remains a big problem, and it does. And part of the problem is that, because of the security vacuum, because Iraqis are afraid. Most of them want the Americans to be there. I mean, I do believe that the majority want the Americans. I mean, they want them to leave when the time comes, and they're not sure they will. I mean, that upsets them. And they're ambivalent about the American presence. But when you say, you know, do you want them to stay? They go, well, no. And then you say, well, do you want them to leave now? And they go, oh, no. You know, so, but they're afraid of really throwing their weight behind the Americans because they're not sure which way this thing is going to go. And people are being killed for collaborating. I've been in many towns where lists have gone up, by some unknown organization. 25 people say, said to be collaborators with the U.S., translators for the military, you know, people working as contractors for the Americans, helping to rebuild Iraq. And, you know, all you have to do is go and shoot one of them. And a translator I know in a town called Balad shot dead. Well, that puts the fear of God into everyone else.
My guest is Anne Garrels. Her new book, Naked in Baghdad, The Iraq War, as seen by NPR's correspondent. You can meet her tonight at Tattered Cover, Cherry Creek, 7:30. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to Enid Live on AM 1150.
This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. I want to thank all our customers and wish them a happy and safe holiday season. Naming a star with StarRegistry.com is one of the most memorable gifts you can ever give. For almost 25 years, we have provided this magical gift to celebrities, dignitaries, even the royal family. For only $54, it's perfect for any occasion and will never be forgotten. Call the Star Registry at 800-282-3333 or visit StarRegistry.com for the gift that shines forever.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Are drugs affecting you, your family, or a friend? Narcanon provides answers to drug addiction. They offer free assessment and referral services to over 11,000 treatment centers nationwide. For 30 years, Narcanon has successfully used a drug-free approach to long-term recovery that works. They understand the cravings, guilt, and depression associated with addiction. To find out more about Narcanon, log on to www.stopaddiction.com or call 1-800-468-6933. Cut through snow and ice easier than ever. Visit your local BMW dealer and ask about the all-wheel drive 3 Series sedans and wagons, X5 and the new BMW X3.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
The Ronald McDonald House offers comfort, hope, and love by providing a home away from home to out-of-town families receiving medical treatment for their children. They could use your help with donations of non-perishable food items and assistance with meal preparation. Both groups and individuals are needed for volunteer programs. If you can help, please call the Ronald McDonald House at 303-832-2667 or go online to ronaldhouse.org.
AM 1150, KNRC is proud to continue a Denver broadcast tradition. The State of Colorado, produced in conjunction with the Denver Press Club and Rocky Mountain Reflections. The State of Colorado is where Greg Dobbs hosts a panel of Denver journalists discussing the major stories of the week every Friday morning from 8 to 9:30. It's the most in-depth analysis and perspective on Denver radio. The State of Colorado is brought to you in part by Denver Center Attractions and International Optique. Friday mornings at 8 on AM 1150, KNRC. The KNRC Community Commitment.
On Thursday, January 15th, the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame will be hosting a fundraising and book signing event showcasing 12 Colorado authors. The event will be held at the Colorado Business Bank located at 17th and Champa Streets from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Meet the authors, including Marilyn Vanderbur Atler and Dottie Lamb. For tickets and information on the Colorado Book Authors signing event Thursday, January 15th, call 303-423-2315. That's 303-423-2315.
Talk to Enid Goldstein.
Kudos again, Enid, for getting these Republicans so riled up. I can't believe they get
You should
riled
see
up.
My emails. Here's Robert. Here's the heading of his email. You are an idiot. I love KNRC, but you are the worst on-air host I've ever heard in my life. I've listened to you many times, and you are the most close-minded, hateful, idiotic person I have ever heard.
Well, see, that shows that you're really getting to them. They're ruffling their feathers.
Enid Goldstein, weekday afternoons from noon till 3 on AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the Enid Goldstein Show on AM 1150 KNRC. Here again, Enid Goldstein.
2:59, we just have a few seconds left. I want to thank Joe Anderson. He is our official producer of the Enid Goldstein Show, so congratulations to you, Joe. I don't know if that's a prize or not, but congratulations anyway. Jordan Lyles, thank you very much for all your help keeping us on the air and all that fabulous music. Thanks to all of you. We'll do it again tomorrow. We're going to have with us Nigel Hamilton, who is Bill Clinton's biographer. It should be juicy. Doug Kellett up next from 3 to 6, 6 to 9, Dominic and Billy. I'm Enid Goldstein. I'll see you back here noon to 3 on
Talk that stimulates your mind. AM 1150. AM 1150. KNRC. People are talking about AM 1150 KNRC.
I work in an office, and I listen to my favorite radio station every day.
I find out everything I need to know about what's going on.
I turn on my radio, I get all the information I need.
Whether it's Iraq or the stock market.
I listen in my car, I listen at work.
When news happens, you guys are on top of it.
You're my new best friend.
Just keep up the great work.
It's what we're here for. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC.
When I tune in,
I'm really pleased.
An open letter to KNRC by yours truly, Jeff. Dear KNRC, I just wanted to tell you that I really enjoy the music that you play on your station. I've heard a lot of really cool tunes that make me feel really good. But as soon as I start to get my groove on, man, you start talking. You talk about the news, you talk about the traffic, the weather, the stock market. You're always talking 24-7. I mean, I like the music you play, but I want to hear the whole song, man. When you start playing the whole song, give me a call. Until then, I'm out of here.
Some people don't get it. For those who understand talk radio, we're here for you. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150, KNRC. Listening to AM 1150 KNRC. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150 KNRC. Inglewood, Denver. Ina Goldstein continues straight ahead. It's 2 o'clock.
AP Network News. I'm Ed Donahue. One of three British Airways daily flights from London to Washington, D.C. has been canceled. The airline says it was the result of security advice from the British government. Jack Garland reports from London there was a problem with the same flight when it landed last night at Dulles Airport.
Yesterday, the same flight was stopped by the U.S. authorities on the tarmac, and everyone was taken off and questioned, and all their baggage was rescreened.
A British government spokeswoman would not comment on whether the flight was canceled because of a specific threat. There are differing views about why an Aeromexico flight was prevented from landing in Los Angeles yesterday. Mexico's president says the flight was canceled because concerns from American security officials that it might be a safety risk. Homeland Security said there was never any plan to prevent the jet from landing in L.A. Tracy Carl in Mexico City reports Mexican President Vicente Fox is not happy with the handling of the situation.
Fox's spokesman Agustin Gutierrez has said that Mexico wasn't given a reason why officials felt the plane was a security risk, and he believes that Homeland Security owes Mexico an explanation. U.S. officials say that they did explain why they felt that the flight was a risk.
Security was tight in Pasadena, California today, but that did not stop some 800,000 people to show up for the Tournament of Roses parade. Correspondent Laura Wide says there were a lot of variety in the various floats.
We've seen singing cactuses, waving octopuses, and snapdragons, just really everything. We're coming up on rodeo riders who are doing lassoing tricks while standing up on their horses.
The parade leads up to the Rose Bowl football game between Michigan and Southern Cal, kickoff set for about a half hour from now. There was a big crowd in Philadelphia for the annual Mummers Day parade. Two separate house fires in northeast Ohio overnight killed six people. A woman and her three sons died in a fire in Fowler Township, Ohio. The dead include four-year-old twins. Also, a man and a woman died in a house fire overnight in Youngstown, Ohio. This is AP Network News. In Dallas today, one person is confirmed dead. Another is believed to be dead in the crash of a small plane into a neighborhood in the city. Roland Herwig is with the FAA in Oklahoma City.
The Belanca BL-17, which was on flying on instrument flight rules out of Dallas Addison Airport, going to Amarillo, with two people on board, crashed into a housing area about 3 miles south of Addison, and this happened at about 10:10 a.m. Central Time.
The cockpit was left covered in debris after the plane struck a garage. Nobody on the ground was hurt. Workers who had been looking for possible survivors in the debris of a Baghdad restaurant found more bodies instead. U.S. military officers at the scene now say 8 people were killed when a car bomb destroyed the restaurant, which had been filled with New Year's Eve revelers. More than 30 people were hurt. Workers are clearing rubble from the scene, and a crane is lifting burned-out cars. The explosion happened as people were getting ready to celebrate New Year's Eve in Baghdad. Survivors of Iran's deadly earthquake are talking about their ordeal. A 12-year-old boy says he heard his father scream, "Get out of the house!" Then his voice went silent. He says he wishes he died that night as well. John Schenck with the humanitarian group World Vision in BAM says quake victims are getting a lot of help.
In front of me right now is a vast array of tents. There's all kinds of organizations here from all over the world. I've talked to, you know, rescue teams from Malaysia, policemen from Austria, you know, humanitarian groups from Ireland. Everybody is here.
The quake killed an estimated 30,000 people. Two members of the Senate Finance Committee are questioning the ability of the Treasury Department to block terrorist money. Charles Grassley, a Republican, and Max Baucus, a Democrat, say the department has failed to freeze the money of people identified as financial supporters of terrorist activities. Congress has a lot on its plate in the new year.
Lawmakers face a lengthy to-do list when they return to the Capitol. For starters, they still have to approve more than half the spending bills for the government's fiscal year, which is already a quarter over. Senate Republican leaders hope to push through an energy bill. It was stalled last year because of a dispute over whether makers of a gasoline additive should be shielded from lawsuits. In the House, a massive $375 billion highway bill was delayed. Some Republicans didn't like the idea of raising gas prices to cover a price tag that was more than $100 billion higher than what the administration had proposed. Jerry Bodlander, Washington.
Good luck trying to look up a phone number in Pastor Ed Sharon's house. Sharon holds the Guinness World Record for the most phone books torn in work news.
I'm Stephanie DeLuca with the KNRC forecast from the Weather Channel. Starting up first day of 2004 with lots of sun, just a few clouds, topping out at 54. Later on tonight, partly cloudy down to 25. And tomorrow, mirror of today, lots of sun, just a few clouds and 54. But for Saturday, the clouds roll in. Chance of snow showers, cooler, high of 25. For the Weather Channel, I'm Stephanie DeLuca on AM 1150 KNRC.
Talk to Lionel.
Everybody's trying to reinvent this thing called dating, meeting. Oh, here's one for you. This one says she's fun-loving. You know, there's nothing better than somebody who loves fun. Really, I love ethnic food. Now, here we go. And 80s movie. You know what we should have? Dumbass. I'm a semi-literate who doesn't know what to say. Basically, what they're saying is, do you really care what movies I like? Here's my picture.
Lionel, weeknights from 9 p.m. to midnight on AM 1150 KNRC.
This is Wally Prue of the Prue Law Firm. If you've been injured, you should speak with a lawyer about your rights and find out whether you have a claim against the person who caused your injury. Not every accident is someone's fault, but many accidents are caused by negligence. Your claim is worth looking into. Let the Prue Law Firm help you deal with insurance companies about your medical bills, lost income, and getting a reasonable settlement for your injury. If necessary, we'll go to court with you. The Prue Law Firm handles many kinds of accidents, like car accidents, wrongful death, slips and falls, dangerous products, medical malpractice, and other types of civil litigation. An initial consultation with the Prue Law Firm is absolutely free. I'm Wally Prue, and I will speak with you personally and honestly about your case. If you're looking for a lawyer who will personally work on your case and not see you just as a potential fee, please call me, Wally Prue, at the Prue Law Firm, LLC, 303-893-8331. Again, that's the Prue Law Firm, 303-893-8331.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
The Ronald McDonald House offers comfort, hope, and love by providing a home away from home to out-of-town families receiving medical treatment for their children. They could use your help with donations of non-perishable food items and assistance with meal preparation. Both groups and individuals are needed for volunteer programs. If you can help, please call the Ronald McDonald House at 303-832-2667 or go online to ronaldhouse.org.
Say it.
You're absolutely correct.
Don't spray it. AM 1150, KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now, the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
2:07, 7 minutes after 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Monday edition of Enid Live. I am yours until 3 o'clock, and joining us is Bev Harris, who has written Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Bev, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You are a great favorite of a lot of people, and all this stuff coming out about Diebold has been pretty horrifying, including what happened in Georgia. But why don't you fill us in about what are some of the dangers of voting electronically? Because in England, they're talking now about not allowing it to happen, or not allowing it to happen without a paper trail anyway.
Good. Well, the problem that we have is that we are not doing correct auditing of the system. It's really an auditing problem. It's not a computer problem. When you have, there's three types of systems that are prone to fraud. One would be financial situations, another is gambling, and another is elections. And in all three of those things, we have to be able to audit what happened in order to deter fraud. What we've done with elections and with electronic voting is we've kind of systematically been taking away the audit procedures so that there's no checks and balances. There are a few left, but they're pretty weak. Now, this is not just for the touchscreen machines. The problem with these touchscreen machines is that they are right now, with the manufacturers that the county elections people have been buying from, do not produce a paper ballot that the voter can verify. However, we also use these optical scan machines, which where you mark, you fill in a dot or you draw an arrow, and they run them through a scanner machine. The problem is with those, we have a paper ballot, but we are locking the paper ballot away in a box, and we never use it to audit the machine tally. So we might as well not have it. So what we're really looking at is we need to have a
In other words, the machine may mistally. And you have the record of it, but they never compare the two.
Right. And, of course, the thing that really counts is what we've actually looked at. We can't see what that machine is recording inside it, but we can look at a ballot that we have marked, or if we're on a touch screen, if it prints a ballot, we can look at that and verify it. And that must be used in some robust way to audit what these machine tallies are. If you don't do that, you are putting a temptation in the way of the programmers of these machines that's just unacceptable.
All right. Now, I'm assuming that when it comes to financial information, for example, someone who would be a genius hacker could hack into your own account and make your bank balance way higher than it should be.
Yes.
And I imagine there are many controls so that that doesn't happen.
Well, you know, one of the biggest controls is that if someone hacks in there and takes money out of your account, you're certainly going to notice that when your check bounces.
Yeah, but what if somebody does the opposite? Since everything is so electronically oriented these days, what if somebody hacked into their own account, evaded the security controls, and made it look like your account was huger than it was?
Well,
so on paper, it looks like it's got a lot of money. You have a lot of money, and you might be able then to withdraw it.
Right, and that kind of thing sometimes does happen. And that is why we have very robust auditing for financial transactions. In other words, what they do that's different in the way that they audit elections versus financial and gambling transactions is this. Financial and gambling transactions, if you want to audit that, as an auditor, if you see any anomaly, you can pull all the records related to that anomaly and just have at it. With elections, they limit how much you can audit by law. So if, for example, in some states, you're limited to a random spot check of 1%
Why would they limit it?
Good question. They've been pulling back the auditor's ability, and you see here, think about this. In Texas, they had an election in one county where three candidates in a row got the same exact number of votes. They all got 18,181 votes. Now, with the type of auditing we do, the auditor would only be able to look at 1% of those ballots, and it wouldn't matter if there was 18181 votes for three candidates in a row. They've already done their 1%. They're not allowed to look at that and pull the records out and see what's wrong. You see, and when you have that kind of a limitation, it's just with elections being what they are, it just invites shenanigans.
Well, it invites fraud. And in your book, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, you say or seem to suggest that verifying the accuracy of electronic voting machines is forbidden. Is that actually the case?
Well, it is, and we're dealing with both. Well, they say it's not forbidden, but for all intents and purposes, it is. Let's look at the two major types of machines that they're bringing in. The touchscreen machine, which doesn't have a paper ballot, and all we can look at is the machine's own record over and over, which is going to be the same thing. If you mistype a word in a Word document, you can make as many copies as you want and put them on as many different machines as you want, and they're all going to have that same mistyped word in it. So if you enter a vote in a touchscreen and it is not recorded correctly the first time, it doesn't matter how many times you audit that machine's count, it's still going to be wrong. With the optical scan, it's a little bit different. You mark your vote, you put it through the optical scan, and then they lock it in a ballot box, and you're not allowed to look at that vote ever unless there's a recount. Well, now, if you were going to tamper with an election, you would simply make sure it doesn't fall within that very tight percentage that triggers a recount. So you actually are encouraging just people to tamper in a bigger way.
Let me ask you this question. There have been some studies, Johns Hopkins, Rice University, the state of Maryland, and this is in relation with reference to Diebold, that they found shocking lapses of security, that there were lots of flaws in the system. I've read where you can go in and hack into the system, change the vote count, and leave no tracks.
Oh, yes, I did that. It took me 10 minutes.
You did that?
And I used the system that's used in my own county. I didn't do it at the official one. I put a simulator on my machine. I wasn't going to, you know, do that. And what recently came out last week in Ohio, and I must commend him for his courage on this, Secretary of State Blackwell from Ohio commissioned a study of all the voting machine manufacturers. All four major manufacturers had multiple critical security flaws. All four of them, not just Diebold. And it didn't surprise me because, you see, the reason we're picking on Diebold so much is that all these companies keep their system a secret and no one's allowed to look at it. Even the election officials aren't allowed to actually look at that source code. Well, last January, I found quite by accident, I was actually using the Google search engine, and I found an obscure web page, and on this web page was a link to 40,000 files from Diebold Election Systems, and it contained the crown jewels. It had just about everything. Not quite everything, but just about. And it's these files that the Johns Hopkins Rice University scientists studied. When we saw what the programs really were, and this is just by accident, it happened to be Diebold, we realized that they did have stunning, stunning security flaws. Since then, the Sequoia machines, another vendor, their software has been found on an open website, and people are looking at that now.
And Sequoia is what I'm told is used in Denver, here in Denver.
Right, and you know, Colorado Springs uses the Diebold touchscreens machine, and there's an interesting situation that I don't know if the folks in Colorado Springs know about. A second set of documents. Now, there's this first set that I found in January, which is this huge stash of program files and manuals and specs and all these things. This fall, an insider, someone with inside access at Diebold, leaked a set of 15,000 internal staff memos where they're all communicating to each other about various problems. And it spans 4 years and all the different employees. In this set of memos, you start to see the ethics of some of these people. They're describing the situation that El Paso County, Colorado, bought touchscreens from Diebold, and they also bought some optical scans, and they wanted to have software that does a certain thing. And so they ordered it. What Diebold did, though, was they sold them something that did not exist. There was no such software. They just said there was. Well, then the El Paso County officials asked for a demonstration of the software. And, of course, the memos show the different programmers are scrambling, and they're saying, how are we going to do a demo? We don't have this software. And so we have the principal engineer, his name is Ken Clark, writes a memo, and he says, for the demo, I suggest you fake it. We've done this before. And he proceeds to tell the technician who's going to be meeting with the Colorado Springs officials how to fake the demo so that he can pick up a check from the county officials.
When was this?
It was just a couple of years ago.
Do you think that the officials ever realized that the demo was faked? Until you have just said it right now, Beth Harris,
so.
On our program.
One of the things that we are doing, I've got two very big stories that we're breaking this week. We're calling them the twin elephants. But
what are they?
Pardon?
What are they?
These are national, and I have an exclusive negotiated with them, but it'll happen late this week, I believe.
Okay.
And then there's then after that, we're going to start going from city to city with the information we know. There's this situation in El Paso County, Colorado. There's a county in Virginia where they sold the county the wrong stuff, and then they decided it would be too expensive to replace it with the right stuff. So they discussed that they will blame it on the officials that bought this and make them feel that it was their decision to buy the wrong stuff so they can make them buy a whole new set of
stuff.
Oh,
no.
It's shocking. And then in Texas, there's a situation in Texas where the files that I found on this Diebold website, along with all their program files, they had personal data, personal information on 310,000 people in Texas. And it was just such a security breach, it was unbelievable.
What kind of, you mean,
they had
voter? Were these 310,000 people voters, or why would they have personal information?
They were voters, and it looked like they started with a voter registration database and expanded on it. And in it, they had their birth date, their first, middle, last name, apartment number, address, the school district their children went to school at, and the way that they vote.
Oh, my goodness.
And so what I'm doing with that one is I thought, I'll just look up the reporters that live in this particular area. I found 20 of them that were on the Diebold FTP site with all their personal information hanging out.
Did you let the reporters know that they...
That's my project next week is all the regional things.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Bev Harris, her book, which you can actually download on the net, is called Black Box Voting. Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, and the website is www.blackboxvoting.org. Bev, in the UK, for example, the Electoral Commission has ruled out e-voting, high-tech methods. We just got this today. This just came across. High-tech methods of voting via email and text message should not be used in next year's elections to local councils and the European Parliament. This was according to a report, and that it was warning, don't use e-methods. In California, Kevin Shelley, who is the Secretary of State there, he's in favor of e-voting, but with a paper trail. What's your feeling about that?
Well, it's too late. He's talking about doing something in 2006.
Right.
From what we have now seen with these systems, they are so prone to fraud that we have got to literally everybody out of the pool. We've got primaries coming up. We need a trustworthy system. And if that means for Iowa and New Hampshire and the next set of primaries coming up that we have to temporarily just go back to the old-fashioned method of paper and a ballot box, that's what we need to do, because we cannot use these machines. What we now know is that they are rife with security flaws, all four manufacturers, that they somehow got through certification, which means the certification system is broken.
Wow. My guest is Bev Harris. Bev, as we continue, I want to talk about Georgia and the upset there. I want to also talk about Ohio and the head of Diebold trying to bring in Ohio for George W. Bush and so on. And you may have questions of Bev Harris. This is pretty shocking information. Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century is the name of her book. Her website, blackboxvoting.org, the number 303-382-1150, 303-382-1150. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to AM 1150 KNRC.
We have word now of a major four-car collision on the westbound side of the Interbelt.
A toxic road spill that has literally shut this road down.
Breaking news.
With winds in excess of 80 miles per hour. Now, residents have been advised to take precautions.
Beforehand, the team with this kind of record even thought about going to a championship game.
The jury has reached their verdict, and as you know, this has been a very long trial.
When there's breaking news, you'll hear it on AM 1150. AM 1150. KNRC. Call the host you don't agree with. Keep both sides alive and well on AM 1150 KNRC. Talk to Doug Kellett.
Watching the news, Thanksgiving Day, Bush is in Iraq, and I could hear the indigestion that was occurring in the stomachs of a lot of my friends on the left here who were getting all upset. We were sitting around watching this, and of course, I'm enjoying all of it. And it was funny, we're sitting there, and I'm like, well, how long will it be? How long will it take before, you know, our Democratic friends will be jumping all over this? He's the commander-in-chief. He left us with Dick Cheney.
Doug Kellett, weekdays from 3 to 6 on AM 1150 KNRC. We'll be right back.
An open letter to KNRC by yours truly, Jeff.
Dear KNRC, I just wanted to tell you that I really enjoy the music that you play on your station. I've heard a lot of really cool tunes that make me feel really good. But as soon as I start to get my groove on, man, you like start talking. You talk about the news, you talk about the traffic, the weather, the stock market. You're always talking 24/7. I mean, like, I like the music you play, but I want to hear the whole song, man. When you start playing the whole song, give me a call. Until then, I'm out of here.
Some people don't get it. For those who understand talk radio, we're here for you. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150, KNIC.
Hi, I'm Enid Goldstein. Get up close and personal with the Colorado Symphony in the only concert hall in America where the music literally becomes the center of attraction. The CSO is offering KNRC listeners 20% off tickets in the Parquet and Mezzanine 1 sections of Betcher Concert Hall for all Masterworks and Super Pops performances. These seats put you practically in the middle of the orchestra. You can watch the conductor's every move and hear the majesty and force of the music build before you.
Don't miss one of R&B's most popular vocalists live in concert with the CSO. Lou Rawls performs for the first time ever with the Colorado Symphony Orchestra on January 2nd and 3rd at Betcher Concert Hall. Tickets available at all King Super's Tickets West outlets and online at www.coloradosymphony.org.
And to get up close and personal with the CSO, call 303-893-4100. That's 303-893-4100.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Have you been considering adoption? There are numerous children in Adams County who need adoptive families. Make a child's dream come true in the new year and foster or adopt a child from Adams County. You do not need to live in Adams County to participate. Call them now at 303-412-5151. That's 303-412-5151. Make your New Year's resolution to fulfill a child's dream and be an adoptive parent for Adams County.
Talk to Greg Dobbs.
Okay, here's real justice. Unmitigated, genuine, obvious, don't argue with me justice. This guy in Tucson yesterday goes up to a Salvation Army setup, and the woman who is volunteering is in a wheelchair herself. She has cerebral palsy. She's 60 years old. This guy comes up, grabs the pot. She struggles with him. He runs with the pot, crosses the street, gets hit by a car.
There is justice out there.
Boy, yes.
Greg Dobbs, weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on AM 1150 KNRC. The KNRC Community Commitment.
On Thursday, January 15th, the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame will be hosting a fundraising and book signing event showcasing 12 Colorado authors. The event will be held at the Colorado Business Bank located at 17th and Champa Streets from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Meet the authors, including Marilyn Vanderburg Atler and Dottie Lamb. For tickets and information on the Colorado Book Authors signing event Thursday, January 15th, call 303-423-2315. That's 303-423-2315.
Fighting large corporate radio. We are Denver's only locally owned and operated talk radio station. Our bosses live and work here. AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. And now, the Enid Goldstein Show continues on AM 1150 KNRC.
2:23 on the Monday edition of Enid Live. It is snowing. Be careful if you're driving. Its visibility has been compromised, although the snow doesn't look like it's sticking yet. Thursday, if everything goes well, we'll have Paul Krugman on from the New York Times. Friday, we'll be live from the Denver Press Club, the holiday edition. With us right now, Bev Harris, her new book, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. She's telling tales of fraud in voting that will make your hair stand on end. And Bev, I guess the thing to talk about here is, and you're the expert on all of this, the 2000 presidential election, was there any fraud in that, what many people don't call an election, they call it a C-election?
Yes. Well, of course, you know, and I have to take my hat off, Greg Tallis did a wonderful job uncovering the completely illegal purge where they knocked about 50,000 people off the rolls that had nothing at all wrong with their record.
That's right. They were largely.
They weren't. And they were primarily, of course, African American.
That's right.
Yeah. But what we found, was really suspicious. I mean, just really appalling. Now a little bit of context. And by the way, let me just actually give it two levels of context. People keep worrying about these touch screens, and I keep telling them the optical scan machines, because we are not properly auditing, are just as dangerous. In fact, they're in more locations than the touch screens, and so I'm really worried about them. This is an example of why we have to have adequate auditing for these optical scans, because this is a situation that happened with an optical scan machine. Now, remember, in Florida, we had, or during the 2000 election, we had an unusual choice of a person to call the election, to make the predicted election results for Fox News. And that was actually George Bush's and Jeb Bush's first cousin, John Ellis. And he was the person who called that election. So he was privy to exactly the amount of number, the spread that they needed in order to make that call for Bush. Interestingly enough, exactly that spread happened to appear in a Diebold voting machine, actually two Diebold voting machines. At that time, they were called global election voting machines, but it's the same exact machine. And what happened is, in Volusia County, Florida, they had an uploaded set of votes, and the votes were correct, and then an hour later, now these votes were correct, they were on a card number, which is like a ballot box, but it's electronic, card number 0. An hour later, card number 3 shows up, and it replaces the votes from card number 0 with new votes. They are all correct, except for the presidential race. And in the presidential race, minus 16,000 votes show up for Gore. Now, first of all, you have to question, if we're thinking these systems are trustworthy, how you can design a computer system that can enter minus votes, negative votes. The second thing is, how can you design a system where you can replace the votes and nobody notices? So minus 16,000 votes showed up for Gore, and in another anomaly, 4,000 extra votes showed up for Bush. This 20,000 votes, combined with another minus 4,000 votes that showed up in Brevard County for Gore, caused the networks to call for Bush.
Oh, my goodness.
And they have, I now have a CBS report. It's an internal report before we discovered this information, in which they knew that there was this error of the negative 16,000 votes.
But then they called it.
It was called an error.
An error. But was it actually an error, Bev Harris?
No, it wasn't an error. It was a replacement set of votes.
It was fraud.
Yes, and let me tell you how we found this. Now, the CBS report identifies how they came to call the election for Bush, and they specifically cite the 16,000 votes that showed up that turned out to be what they thought was an error. And they say twice in the report, we would not have called the election except for these bogus votes.
And the polls were still open in a lot of places, too, weren't they,
this is the second time they called. You know, they called it for Gore, and then they called it for Bush. And they called it for Bush about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, okay.
Here's how damaging this was. Based on these bogus votes, which appeared in the Diebold machines, Al Gore then called and privately conceded the election to Bush. He then wrote a concession speech. He was 2 blocks from delivering that speech in public when he discovered that these were bogus votes.
And?
Now think about this. If he had conceded the election, would there have ever been a recount? Would we have ever even found any of this out? This is terrible. This is a situation where a voting machine caused a candidate to concede a presidential election
based on
its problem.
Who programmed that voting machine? Did you ever find a person connected to this?
Oh, that will be part of the story that I'm bringing out this week. One of the next things that we are finding is that there are a very small number of people who have had access into these machines, because I won't even go into the next thing. There will be something that will be breaking late this week, but be patient on that. But in this particular situation in Volusia County, they did find the negative 16,000 votes. And it's kind of funny. An NBC reporter saw that the votes were actually, slipping away. Think, wait a minute, the votes are going the wrong direction. And so they did find it, and they had a lawsuit, and they did a hand count and so forth. But so the damage that was actually done there was, and it appears to me that was an effort to get a premature concession out of Gore, frankly. And the way that we found out the real reason for it, by the way, was when this set of memos was leaked. On September 5th, I was sent about 15,000 internal memos by someone with a leaker, basically, with someone with inside access. And in the memos, there were a series of memos about Volusia County. They were dated right after the election. And I will never forget this quote. You have an employee for Volusia County who writes to the people, at that time it was called Global Election Systems. She writes to the principal engineer and the head guy, and she says, "Can someone please tell me how I can explain this negative 16,000 votes so I don't have to stand here looking dumb?" And so you have all these different memos flying back and forth where all the different engineers are trying to come up with a reason.
Beb, talk to me about Georgia, because in
Georgia,
that election, Max Cleland, who was called unpatriotic, this is a man who left three of his limbs in Vietnam, was ahead by something like 2 to 5 points before the election, was expected to win re-election as senator. And then you also had a very popular Democratic governor who was as high as, what, 9 or 11 points ahead of his challenger. They both lost by huge amounts. The pollsters could not have been off by that much. And this was Georgia using these electronic voting machines for the first time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Georgia did a radical thing. They went out and they replaced all the voting machines in their whole state with Diebold touch screens that have no paper ballot. That's 22,000 machines in 159 counties. Did it in one fell swoop. What people did not know when they were voting is that a month before the election, well, actually from October 1st to November 1st, the election was held on November 5th, they replaced the program in all 22,000 machines with a replacement program that nobody ever looked at to see what was in it. And to this day, nobody knows what was in it.
Why was the replacement program
used? Well, they say
used?
It was because they were having problems with screen freezings. But you see, then we trace that back. I actually found a technician who was instructed by Diebold to make these replacements earlier on. They were doing replacement files all the way back from June of 2002 and then into July and August. And they were having a lot of problems with their machines. They were having huge quality control problems, which then calls into question how these machines ever got through all the certification and testing they promised us. He said he was the one who checked the machines in when they arrived in Georgia, and 25% of the machines wouldn't even boot up. You know, they had huge problems. And so you had a guy in Canada who was single-handedly writing fixes, putting them on the web at night, and then telling these guys, download this fix to your laptop and go put it in the computer and overwrite the program with these files.
And that's,
I mean, how dangerous
is this? And that was where some of the security breaches happened. Is it really, talk to me about how you can go into the system, change the votes without ever being caught. Now they say in hard drives and stuff, they can recover everything. The FBI recovers stuff that you think you've deleted and so on. How is that possible in voting? That there are no tracks left?
If you brought in the FBI and they did a complete forensic analysis of the computer, they probably could find it. But whoever does that. What I found, now you see the voting systems are at two levels. They're the ones in the polling place where you go and you either do your optical scan vote and put it through the scanner, or you do your touch screen and you do that. Those results are then accumulated and sent to the county, and the county accumulates from all the different polling places and then sends the report to the official results. Well, so we've got the software that's in these polling places. That's one type of software. And then we've got the software at the county, which accumulates everything. And so I thought, well, gee, if I was going to do something, I would go for that county. You know, I could get all the different polling places at once. Why run around from polling place to polling place? And so I grabbed this program called GEMS, which I found on the Diebold site, and I installed it on my computer. And I actually worked with about, over the course of the last year, I've worked with about 22 different programmers who've really helped me. I would never be able to figure this out. I did figure all by myself, without their help, I figured out how to bypass the password. In fact, using the technique, it was really easy. I figured out how to get around the password of any election supervisor in the United States. It was shocking. So then I thought, well, maybe I can, change the votes. But I had this source, and a lot of my sources go by screen names or unattributed names, mainly because they were concerned about examining this software and their legal liability and so forth. But this particular person was a very well trained, people would be surprised at his credentials. He calls me up in the morning, and just like a tech does, where they walk you through that stuff, he's like, okay, now, click into your GEMS program and click this and add, go over there and do this. Now do it. And basically by setting you could go in through a back door, which was set up that way. A back door meaning a way that nobody really, you know, kind of an illicit way to get into the program. And you could be in there changing the votes. And you could actually, if you had remote access, you could actually be doing this while the election supervisor has the election running live, and she would never see you in there because for some reason they set it up for multiple users at the same time.
Have you been threatened?
I'm not going to go into any of that.
Legal action.
People. Yeah, so we'll skip that.
Okay.
But so basically you can go tool around, you can change the votes, and then they have something which they tell everyone is the big protection, which is an audit log, which is supposed to log every event that happens, except if you go in the back door, in which case it logs nothing. And let me tell you how difficult it is to hack this audit log. You have to be able to double-click a file and type.
Oh, wow. Well, there's some qualifications for you. My guest is Bev Harris. Her book is called Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. This is really shocking information, Bev. If you can stay with us through the news, I want to find out what ordinary citizens can do and how we can make ourselves heard and how we can have some serious input here that won't simply be vaporized by some black box voting apparatus. I mean, at Goldstein, my guest, Bev Harris, her book, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century, 303-382-1150. You're listening to Enid Live on AM 1150, KNRC.
Jim Conder here talking with Bev Rouleau from International Optique. Bev, fashion eyewear the best in the city and now a sale. Bev, what's up with that?
Jim, International Optique is having our annual sale now through January 15th, and it's a blowout.
I know the details. If you purchase prescription frames and lenses at International Optique at Tamarack Square or International Optique at University and Orchard, you receive a 25% discount.
It's a family affair at International Optique. Just bring your family and friends. Everyone receives 25% off their new frame and lenses.
And don't forget to use your Flex dollars while saving money. If you run out of time to use your Flex dollars, come in for a gift certificate to be used later.
Jim, the excitement about International Optique is that we carry frames with a little attitude or a lot of attitude. Either way, let our staff make sure you walk out looking beyond fabulous.
For the best in eyewear in Denver, join International Optique at Tamarack Square or International Optique at University in Orchard now through January 15th for their spectacular 25% off prescription frame and lens sale. It's not what you know, it's who you know, and we know International Optique.
An open letter to KNRC by yours truly, Jeff.
Dear KNRC, I just wanted to tell you that I really enjoy the music that you play on your station. I've heard a lot of really cool tunes that make me feel really good. But as soon as I start to get my groove on, man, you start talking. You talk about the news, you talk about the traffic, the weather, the stock market. You're always talking 24/7. I mean, I like the music you play, but I want to hear the whole song, man. When you start playing the whole song, give me a call. Until then, I'm out of here.
Some people don't get it. For those who understand talk radio, we're here for you. Hear both sides talk. AM 1150, KNIC.
Wow, I can't believe it. 50 years. Hi, this is Keith Lair with my sister Linda asking you to come see Lair Fireplace and Patio for all your fireplace needs and help us celebrate our 50th year in business.
Lair's is truly a family business. With our brother Ken at our Arvada store at 81st and Sheridan, I'm at our Littleton store on South Broadway, just north of Arapahoe Road, and Keith is at our original store in Denver at Holly and Evans.
When our father, Joe Lair, started in 1954, he had a very simple philosophy. Sell quality products and treat your customers fairly. You know what? It's worked for 50 years.
That's why we carry quality fireplaces and inserts from Heat & Glow.
If you're building, remodeling, or converting an existing fireplace to gas, check out the superior construction and efficiency of Heat & Glow.
You know, the fireplace is the focal point of most rooms, so do it right. Don't skimp. Get a Heat & Glow. Our expert installers can give you a free estimate right in your home.
That's Lair Fireplace and Patio, Denver's most trusted fireplace specialist for 50 years.
The KNRC Community Commitment.
Looking for love in all the wrong places? Try the Max Fund Animal Adoption Center, located at 1025 Galapago Street. The Max Fund is the only no-kill shelter in the Denver area for injured animals with no known owners. They have numerous loving cats and dogs available for adoption, and also offer low-cost spays and neuters. To find a friend or volunteer your time, call 303-595-4917 or go to www.maxfund.org.
We have word now of a major four-car collision on the westbound side of the Interbelt.
A toxic road spill that has literally shut this road down.
Breaking news.
With winds in excess of 80 miles per hour. Now, residents have been advised to take precautions
beforehand. The team with this kind of record even thought about
jury has reached their verdict. And as you know, this has been a very long trial.
When there's breaking news, you'll hear it on AM 1150. KNRC. You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. Our contact number, 303-382-1150.
We hear you.
303-382-1150. Close is your phone. 303-382-1150. KNRC.
241 on the Monday edition of Enid Live. I'm yours until 3 o'clock, and with me, Bev Harris, whose book is Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. I mean, the information you're giving us, Bev, is really so shocking. I think people think, or have thought, maybe have not thought too much about it, that voting is so much more secure in this country than it turns out that it actually is.
Right. It's, I think, the hardest thing about this. People understand the story in about 2 minutes. The hardest part is emotional, because this is really uncomfortable. And I understand that I may sound like I'm just barreling ahead and I'm totally comfortable with it. That's because I've been looking at this information for over a year now. But I can tell you about last December and January, when I was first really starting to see the scope of this problem. It was so overwhelming. It really was. I think, you know, I have this wonderful husband who's just the most down-to-earth guy in the world, and I really was helped by him, because, frankly, I was looking at it just going, what in the world am I looking at? What am I seeing here? This is really scary.
What's your background?
Pardon?
What's your background?
Oh, I've been a writer for many years. And
but what caused you to look into voting?
I for the last 7 years, I've been a literary publicist, because if you're a writer, you can always choose to write the things that you really enjoy, and I really enjoyed that kind of work. But years before that, I wrote about financial fraud and embezzlement. I had 3 or 4 different projects where I was dealing with that. And I read an article last fall, about a year ago, about some concerns about the taking away the paper ballot, and also about, you know, not really knowing who owned the companies. And I thought, well, you know, I literally thought it was going to be just a 10 or 20-minute thing. Over lunch, I'll just look up and see who owns the companies, and then I'll send this lady an email, because, you know, I kind of knew where to find that. And then the first thing I found was that a guy who was a Republican senator who was currently running for office, you know, had a $5 million stake in it and had been the CEO and chairman of the company that's machines was counting his own votes. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. And so I got kind of intrigued with it. And then as I started looking into it more and more, every time I asked a question, the wrong answer was coming up. And I thought, you know, I really didn't want to take this on. But I knew that I had the ability to communicate this problem, to understand it, and to investigate it. And
A fantastic job, but I would imagine that the big manufacturers have threatened with lawsuits. Have you had to fend off?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've had to fend off lawsuits?
Well, yeah. The first thing that happened when I exposed the ownership of election systems and software, and exposed the fact that Senator Chuck Hagel from Nebraska had been its CEO and chairman and had failed to disclose that on his disclosure
document. Oh, my goodness.
He simply omitted it. He said he had a volunteer position with the American Red Cross, but he sure didn't mention that he was the chairman of the voting company that counted his votes. And when I put that on the website, I got a cease and desist letter from ESNS lawyers, which said take it off the website. So, of course, you know, what I did was send their cease and desist order along with all of the documents about Chuck Hagel out to 3,000 reporters. And, you know, the worst thing that they can do is send you a cease and desist, because the first thing a reporter does is says, well, what am I not supposed to see? What's in there?
Exactly. It's like a red flag. All right. What can ordinary citizens do? We can buy your book, and your book is called, or we can download it also. Your book is called Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century.
Right. And one of the best things you can do is we set up this great website, blackboxvoting.org. It's all about the forum there. It's got an activism forum where people are really doing things. And it seems like, oh, it's not just where you go and converse about voting. There's at least 3 projects going on at any given time. And in fact, one of the things we're going to need fairly soon here, we've got over 120 people who've logged into the talent pool with talents, and we need a volunteer coordinator, you know, so that we can say, well, we need to collect, you know, the numbers. I need, right now, for example, I need someone to add up the numbers of voters voters in a bunch of different counties so I can provide it to a reporter. And so we need somebody, basically get in and sign into the forum and say what you're good at. And if you're a good organizer, by all means, let us know that, because we're going to need four or five people to get in there and marshal the troops.
Should we also be barraging our legislators, our senators, our representatives, and so on?
Absolutely. They are already getting barraged. And what we have to do is know what message we want to barrage them with. What they have been getting barraged with is they want everyone wants them to pass a bill called House H.R. 2239, which is good because it gives us a paper ballot, but it does not give us the audit solution. So, and it does not give us, it's too far down the road. What we are calling for is an immediate short-term interim solution so that we can trust what happens in the primaries. Now, it isn't that much rocket science. If we have to get out there and just get paper ballots for one primary election, big deal, let's do it, because we need to be able to trust the result.
Yeah, but you're going to have all the big voting machine companies coming out to say if they're willing to fake information and fake out software that they don't even have not even yet developed and make the county officials seem like they're the ones at fault and scapegoat them, mm-hmm. think of what they will do to you, that we can't do paper ballots. They don't want to do anything.
Any challenge that will undercut
their system, they're going to fight you.
They're going to fight it tooth and nail. But you see, that's the thing is, this has been something that's mobilized people like nothing I've ever seen before. And frankly, if we all have to march in and vote absentee and then stand there and demand that they count our ballot and not just stick it in a box.
Voting absentee assure that a more honest count than
No, but if you're in El Paso County, Colorado, you want to make sure that you at least vote on paper. Now, the problem is that they're not going to look at that ballot, and they can still do just as bad things with that optical scan machine, which is what they use to scan your absentee vote. However, that way you only have half as much to deal with. Then you just have to be – then as citizens, we just need to insist that we look at the paper ballot.
All right, now
let's look at it.
Tell us again, why is the optical scan system as awful as the e-voting?
Because we're not auditing it. We're not doing we're not taking the paper ballot and comparing it with the machine tally in any kind of meaningful way.
Can anybody alter that system at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's in fact the system that I described that I hacked is used for both the optical scan and the touch screen. It's the central count, so you can alter one, you can alter the other.
So you can alter from a distance by electronically without ever leaving tracks both the optical scan system and the touch voting system, the e-system.
Yes, and I just found out this weekend, in fact, the programmer for the optical scans had actually set up a bidirectional system where they could send data both directions, in other words, out of the optical scan to the county, but also back into it. Which, I'm sorry, but I don't understand any legitimate reason to send vote information into an optical scan.
What is the most shocking thing, Bev Harris, in all of your research here, and you are the one that is really at the center of it, black box voting, ballot tampering in the 21st century, what's the most shocking thing you've come upon?
The most shocking thing I've come upon is I'll tip my hand here because this is what we're going to be breaking with documentation. We have literally had one man who's had his hands on 2 million votes in the United States, unsupervised.
Oh.
We have four such people that I've been able to identify who've had their hands on votes unsupervised.
If you were able to document this and prove this, are there laws? What are the laws? Are there laws in place? Are there laws in place that would really handle this, or are they yet to be created?
Well, it's completely against the law. The question is, what do we do about it? I think what we need to do is I think the United States Congress is going to play a historic role in this because they really need, I don't care who's in there, Republicans or Democrats, they really need to do a full-fledged and congressional investigation.
Why didn't somebody like Matt Cleland or the governor of Georgia, who was ahead by 9 or 11 points, and both of them lost big when they were ahead big time, why didn't they institute some kind of a lawsuit, some kind of something? Why did they just take the results and slink off into the night?
Well, of course, we didn't really find out until, at least 6 months later that there were really, about all these patches and all these strange things. So it was like, every time people were trying that before, people would go, oh, how dare you say that there would be dishonest people. We're just now starting to realize how flawed these systems are. And by the way, if we don't go to something like an emergency interim paper ballot in the next couple of months, every single contest at some point is going to be contested. You understand that? I mean, the candidates for all major manufacturers now have the grounds to sue.
The 20,000 votes that it turned out were fraudulently dealt with in Florida, mm-hmm. were they ever restored to the
yes.
properly?
In this case, they were. And
it was too late, really.
A dramatic situation, you know, because it was obvious there can't be such a thing as negative 16,000, so that was caught. What concerns me is Florida had 30 counties being counted by these same machines. What if you had, you know, 15 counties each had 500 votes? Then no one ever would have noticed. I mean, for each situation we catch, how many are there that are just not obvious and we don't catch?
Bev Harris, I thank you so much for the good work that you do and for joining us today. Her book, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Where should we be looking later this week when these big stories break?
Oh, be looking to the major media.
The major media, and also
with both the major print and the TV networks, and because I think what we can safely say is the biggest security breach in the history of our electoral system. We have had one individual with his hands on millions of votes at once, unsupervised, with no oversight.
Can we? When will this? The story will break. What day do you suppose?
Well, hopefully, I've turned all the stuff over, and of course, you know, they have to do their fact checking and verify everything that I've given them, and it's a little bit complex because they're having to go back into some old records and so forth. So I'm hoping that by Wednesday, but it may be as late as Thursday or Friday.
By sometime between Wednesday and Friday, and mm-hmm. my producer Joe Anderson will call you to find out when that happy moment occurs, and
okay.
we'll do something on it as well. Bev
right.
Harris, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the fine work that you've done on behalf of all of us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. I'm Enid Goldstein. You're listening to AM 1150 KNRC.
KNRC Community Commitments.
Spreading the holiday spirit and celebrating the opening of its newest store in Southeast Aurora, Lowe's is bringing SpongeBob SquarePants to the Children's Hospital of Denver. Lowe's volunteers are now redesigning and transforming the hospital's child outpatient health clinic into a seaworthy adventure. Upon completion of the project on Tuesday, December 23rd, Lowe's and SpongeBob will celebrate with the children by delivering gifts to them at the Children's Hospital of Denver.
Say it.
You're absolutely correct.
Don't spray it. AM 1150, KNRC. One side of us says gloating about Greg Dobbs being named Denver's best talk show host by Westword is wrong. The other side of us says, why not? Lucky for us, we listen to both sides. AM 1150, KNRC.
Welcome and good evening. Soon, one of these lucky ladies will be crowned Miss Kumquat of Monroe County. The envelope, please. Miss Debbie Andrews. I have good news.
I can't believe I won.
You didn't.
Huh?
I just saved a bunch of money on car insurance by switching to Geico.
See what you could save. Call 1-800-947-AUTO. Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance.
Cut through snow and ice easier than ever. Visit your local BMW dealer and ask about the all-wheel drive 3 Series sedans and wagons, X5 and the new BMW X3.
You're listening to the best of Enid Goldstein on AM 1150 KNRC. You're listening to the Enid Goldstein Show on AM 1150 KNRC. Here again, Enid Goldstein.
2:55 on the Monday edition of Enid Live. Well, things are hopping in here, and they're hopping outside, too. So if you're in the weather, be careful as you drive. Visibility's not wonderful, and traffic conditions are probably not going to be too perky on your drive around town or home tonight. Well, this just in. Started with Molly Ivins in her column today. I saw it in one of the Denver papers, either the Rocky or the Post. I can't remember which one. She says she's going for Dean. Guess who else has just endorsed Dean? It's just in, Al Gore. He has agreed to endorse Dean in Harlem in New York City today and to travel with Dean to Iowa. So more as it develops, but Al Gore has endorsed Dean. Let me ask you, is that a plus or a minus for Dean, do you think? How's that going to work? And what did you think about Bev Harris If you just tuned in, we're going to put that up on the website and that interview because it's important information. She's the author of Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. So to think that your vote doesn't count at all, it's so tragic because so few of us actually get up off our behinds and vote. And to think that you go and you do it and it doesn't count because the system has been manipulated unfairly. She says a big story is going to be breaking, and that story is that one individual controls millions, a couple of million votes. And we haven't known about that, so we are going to be on the lookout for that story. But again, the Bev Harris interview, a lot of you were very interested in her being on today, and I'm getting emails, and Greg is just emailing and said, could we talk, she talks about, all right, so Greg is talking about it, and it's too long for me to go through right now. I got an email from Eric, and I want to share this with you because one of the things we're talking about is George W. Bush, why people are going to vote for him again, even though he's done an abysmal job, probably the worst job of any president I've ever lived through, any regime that I've ever lived through. And I thought it was because he's so he's got this ability to connect with people. But Eric makes this point, and it's a good point. The reluctance of people to admit they were duped is not due to any misplaced allegiance toward Bush. He says, I believe that Bush connects with people and that this accounts for his popularity. Eric, in contrast, believes that the Bush supporters don't have any particular affinity for Bush the man, but rather their allegiance is toward their own political philosophy. These people, who are conservatives, think that Bush embodies the conservatism they feel is advantageous to themselves, never mind that most people voting Republican actually vote against their own interests unless they are wealthy to start with. Bush's popularity may be a mile wide, but it is certainly an inch deep. So it's about voting your political philosophy. Hal in Denver, hi, you're live with Enid. Hi, Hal.
How you doing? You should answer. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
Tell me quick.
You think the word duplicitous applies to Bush? I wouldn't say diabolical, but maybe duplicitous.
Dishonest, duplicitous, a liar, all of those will work.
You know, someone pointed out to me that the biggest voting bloc in the United States is the people who don't vote. That would swing an election hugely.
Well, it would, but so how are we going to get them to vote on these systems that mangle their votes?
Well, now that's another issue. But I think if you had the people who didn't vote, they could change the course of the country.
Well, that's true. But how do we get them to vote? If you had a brother, would he like cheese? He might like cheese. But how are you going to have a brother?
Make them mad.
Hal, I thank you. I mean, yes, the biggest there are a lot. Most people do not vote.
It's 3 o'clock.
From specific information about security, we don't know whether it was a specific threat. The UK government here doesn't comment on matters of security. That's all we know.
The same flight was kept on the tarmac yesterday at Dulles Airport outside Washington. Security concerns also forced the cancellation of a New Year's Eve Aeromexico flight from Mexico City to Los Angeles. Correspondent Tracy Carr reports on that from Mexico City.
The flight was scheduled to take off yesterday at 5:05 p.m. for Los Angeles, but Homeland Security contacted Aeromexico and told them that they were concerned that the plane could be a security risk. So Aeromexico canceled the flight, and it never got off the ground. The passengers were put on a Mexicana flight and allowed to fly to Los Angeles the same day.
Two powerful members of the Senate Finance Committee are questioning a federal agency's ability to block terrorist money. Iowa Republican Charles Grassley and Montana Democrat Max Baucus voiced their concerns in a pre-Christmas letter to the Office of Foreign Asset Control. Correspondent John Solomon has more on that from Washington.
They can take their appeal to the state.
Wasting a lot of these elaborate